It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
No fear, no fear, no fear, no fear, no fear here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock. We're still in Lancaster, New Hampshire, up near the Canadian border at Rogers Campground. And it's been awesome. We've had a lot of fun. And this week is Fork Fest. There's still a lot of people here. It's probably 15-20% of 3,000. So it's, you know, hundreds. And, you know, we're just chilling. I mean, you know, it's just, that's what I like about Fork Fest, man. We just, you know, we're just, you know, the real camping kind of vacation thing where Fork Fest is just thing after thing after thing, you know, and parties and speeches and presentations and places to go. It was packed. You know, they have 400 or 500 spots up here. I mean, it's a lot. It's at least 350. Plus, I think they have a lot of tent places and all that. So, you know, 500 spots with like five tents on every spot. I mean, it's that kind of thing. So there was easily over 3,000 people here, I think. And, but it was chill. You know, it was one of the better years. When that happens, though, and this pertains to what we're going to be talking about today, when that happens, all of a sudden, well, next year is going to be bigger, badder, and we're going to make more money and charge and make sure you can't do that. And there's a permit for it. I mean, it always happens. Then it kind of goes down. People like, and they do like competitive events up here. Fork Fest kind of forked off. Look, you guys want to get all anal? We'll just go over here. We'll just stay in camp or week before, week after. Like, whoa, 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 whoa. You're not. And they kind of open up. Then it gets popular and then they do it all over again. I mean, you know, it's just, it happens like that. It's just, it's human nature because they want to collectivize stuff. They want to, you know, exploit the numbers, the money. They got a plan. There's something, it's always somebody else's plan that you got to join our plan and form fill out. Now, what's happening now is for you to get a spot up here, you have to get a Fork Fest ticket, and then you can get spots during that time, which is fine. I mean, you know, whatever, because people, a lot of times they'll get here the week earlier or stay later or something anyway. But we'll see what happens. This next year is going to be, I've been doing this 13 years here. Jackalope Freedom Festival, we started in Arizona. It's been in its 10th year, and it's just in the forest with there is no permit. There is no nothing. You get like 2 weeks before anybody even bothers you anyway, and then you just stay anyway. But this is different. And when the more successful it is, the more the bureaucracy starts. So that's what we're going to be talking about with Mark Angelo Coppola, you know, Valhalla Farms in Montreal. And, you know, intentional communities is really what we're going to be focusing on. And well, what does that mean? Intentional. What's contract? How does that work? Now, COOPFERMES Valhalla. So Coop Fermes, what kind of word is that, man? What language are we talking about here?
It means co-op, cooperative, essentially.
All right. Co-op Fermes. What's Fermes?
Ferm is, so it means farm in French.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a cooperative French
cooperative
farm.
Exactly. Okay. Yep.
All right. Co-op Fermes Valhalla, VALHALLA.com. You go into today's show archive and they'll have all these contacts and information and everything. And we'll get to it. All right. Now, Mark Angelo, we need to know about him, you know, so we can understand what's kind of gotten built and where the future is. He tells stories to build movements and help train people to follow their passions while scaling both the return on investment of return on investment and the other you know, return on investment of ripple of impact. Okay, ripple of impact. Explain that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, here's the thing, you know, as you were saying, there's so many competing forces that are, you know, ingrained into human nature, but also ingrained into society. And society in the way that we operate society today is a society of money, right? Who has money, who has capital essentially gets to make the decisions. And I say that because the person who owns the land tends to have the capital who then makes the decisions. And it kind of creates a system of classes, right? And whether those classes are fair or not, well, some people think that the free market and the way that the capitalist system works is really great and fair, and it works for the people who have the capital, but for those who don't have the capital, they struggle, obviously. So the question becomes, how do you empower yourself, you know, to be as free as possible, as, you know, a citizen of whatever country? I'm up in Canada, others are in America or in Europe or wherever it is. How do you kind of step into your own self-empowerment? And to me, that looks like being empowered to have the ROI of essentially taking your time, energy, resources, and earning a living, right? Being empowered to do the things that you're passionate about. And that's the kind of traditional, you know, definition of return on investment. And then you've got the other ROI of ripple of impact. How can you use your resources, time, energy, you know, capacity, essentially, your passions, your gifts, to essentially have a bigger impact than just you and your own personal wealth and your own well-being? And what it really looks like is trying to solve what, you know, is a very common issue, which is called the tragedy of the commons, right? What's good for me is bad for the whole. So it's great for me that I build some big mansion and I have all, you know, access to all the resources and all the things that I want from all over the world. But over time, that kind of creates a problem where if everyone lived like the average American or the average Canadian, we would need way too many planets to survive, right? So at the end of the day, we need to balance the ecological capacity of our planet and the kind of needs and wants and some frivolous, some, you know, necessity that come with living on this earth. And so how do you do that, right? The truth is we don't fully know. It's part of an experiment. It's not something we were socialized to learn. It's not the system that we grew up in. It's not the system of education that brought us to understanding these different things, because the system of education was really grooming us to have a job, essentially, right? Go get a skill, get your 9-to-5, pay your bills, pay your mortgage, and be happy with, you know, your shoebox in the city, or be happy with your home in suburbia or whatever that looks like. And that's great. That works for some people. You know, it's obviously a great life in some ways. And at the exact same time, you know, I would love to push the limits of what that looks and feels like. I love to push the limits of, you know, my own personal freedom and abundance, but also more so communal freedom and abundance. And I think that there's so much power. There's so much more we can have if we share. And so it might seem like very simplistic, but how does that work when it's like, okay, we don't all need a ladder, but we need access to a ladder when we need a ladder, right? That 1 or 2 days a year that we need a ladder to go up on the roof and clean the gutters or whatever it is. So how do you share that resource? Well, it's great if we have the resource all pooled together with a group of people, because then we don't all have to own our own ladder. But at the same time, there's always these complications that come with agreements, that come with communal living or communal sharing of some in some way, shape, or form.
And okay, let's go ahead and take a break here. This is what I want to get into.
Yeah.
How long have you been doing this, actual boots on the ground when you started this? How long has passed?
So boots on the ground. This is our 9th season at the farm. So up
okay,
here.
So long enough.
Yeah, yeah, long enough. We've survived. We survived the, you know, let's say the 5-year time frame where most startups or most communities tend to fail.
All right. The mission, Valhalla Farms, Montreal, to transform an 80-plus acre farm through the power of regenerative agriculture and storytelling to build a thriving all-natural ecosystem that inspires a community of passionate agricultural producers. Oh, my God, they're going to feed themselves. Yay. And entrepreneurs to come together to build the farm of the future. All right, we can talk about what that means. Valhalla Montreal builds and develops a practical educational site focused on sustainable solutions relating to human needs such as food, shelter, water, energy, and social structure. Oh, man, if you ain't the experiment, what are you looking for? Okay. All right. So an educational site. You know, they always go, well, it's educational. You know, that helps with some other things. All right. Our philosophy. Yeah. Yep. Permaculture, permanent culture, is a philosophy of working with nature through observation of all the functions of each element to design whole systems. Valhalla Montreal is applying principles of permaculture in all aspects of the project. So this is, to me, we'll get into it, but to me, this is like, you know, I can walk outside, feed myself, and, you know, it's always going to be there in a grocery store that's alive, and duh. And you don't waste a whole bunch of space or time or what, you know, I'm in. Natural building. There are many solutions today that function passively using natural or reused materials such as hemp, earth ships, cob houses, rocket stoves, and compost showers. These innovative technologies provide accessible change for everyone. Compost showers. That doesn't sound good rolling off the tongue, but I know you mean, you know, to heat the water, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can use compost as in compost toilets. You can use, you know, compost to kind of turn the soil and put compost in your garden beds. But you can also use the heat from compost to potentially heat your shower.
Yeah, you know, so it's not compost shower.
Oh, you're not like, showering in the
compost. A load of rotting fish dumped on us every morning. Okay, so not that. Sociocracy. I mean, man, am I even saying that right? Sociocracy, man, that's a new one. We're going to talk about that one. Is a self-managed decision-making model for organizations and communities. Valhalla Montreal implements sociocracy. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, you are.
Okay, sociocracy to ensure that all members are included in the decision-making while still being efficient in our decision-making. Mean somebody rules. There's a ruler committee of rule. Okay, we're gonna find out. Nonviolent communication is a conflict resolution process that allows members to communicate from a place of empathy and understanding, gives the tools to connect even with those who don't practice it. Okay, we need to talk, you know, nonviolent communication has been a big thing, even up here at Porkfest over the years, of how to communicate between couples, how to deal with your children. It's a method of communication. Everybody gets to have their say. And then is there still king? I don't know. We're going to find out. Be sure to check out our website, Valhalla Movement, V-A-L-H-A-L-L-A, movement.com, for updates on current projects and what's in store for the future, along with uplifting, informative videos and articles. Also, if you want to help out in any way or simply want to visit our site. Okay, now this is the thing. Mark Angelo Coppola, I'm sure we're going to have a great conversation. And the thing is that he's in marketing mode. It's like that joke, you know, where they're campaigning for hell. You know, they're going, oh, yeah, come on down, man. We're all, you know, standing around drinking coffee. And then you go down there and they're upside down with their heads in crap. Oh, we were campaigning then, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, so this is what, you know, I suspect you're going to give the best, you know, face forward. And the fact that you're even there 9 years means that you did something. I mean, so we're going to get into the nitty-gritty a little bit. We're going to find out how you got here. Yep. And, you know, some of the things that you start, the one that I'm most interested in, there is definitely, and I've convinced myself on our own property of doing aquaponics and chickens and turkeys and goats and on 2 acre irrigated plot in Phoenix, freaking 123 degree Arizona with 70 foot pine trees I got, because you add water, it grows. All right. Mm-hmm. I go to Arizona out in the desert. I get a well. It's going to be okay. So the reason it's okay is because, you know, solar, you got to have power. You know, so I'm interested in how you guys do power. Mm-hmm. And so this is technically possible. They're going to go moon, Mars. I mean, it's possible. That's definitely not the problem. It's the social part of it. Yep. It's always, you know, you get away from they, them, those that bother you won't leave you alone. And they move in and they're your neighbors. I mean, so, you know, how do you go through this process? There's a gentleman in Northern California that we interviewed, and he has an agreement, you know, and it has, you know, it's starting to get into the nitty gritty. And it comes down to, how do you get rid of the bad actors, the bad guys? How do you prevent them from being there? You know, they have like autonomy is a, you know, a self-improvement kind of thing for liberty-minded people here, done by Richard Grover, Tragedy and Hope. They had 70 of their guys here. They went through, you know, 5 classes, 500 people or so have been going through this thing, and they got a 5-hour orientation. They call it an obstacle course. 5 hours to even apply. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going, all right, if I'm going to be living with you and not just, you know, in a Discord doing thing on the internet, I'm thinking it's like a 5-year application of you living here. You see my point? Mm-hmm. All right. So this is where I'm coming from. I wanted to make sure Mark kind of gets the gist. We had a little pre-interview, so he knows what we're going to be talking about. So we're going to take our time and walk through this. Mark, your earliest memory at 3 years old, you know, or, you know, I'm serious, you know, it's like your parents, an uncle, a boss, a teacher, a coach, you know, a sibling. I said all that, and one girl find out later it was her brother, but I didn't say brother, you know, so it's an hour before I found out it was her brother. But anyway, so there's somebody, something, some book, some movie, some advertise, something that made you even this way, give a crap and want to do this. Tell us.
Yeah, I think, you know, my earliest memory is me actually on a trip with my parents. We had visited Italy. So I'm of Italian descent. My parents are both, you know, Italian, you know, in nature. And the earliest memory that I have is actually sitting at this round table, kind of wooden round table, super classical, in Italy somewhere. I don't know where we were. I remember a little dog barking. He was behind kind of a screen door. He was outside. I was inside. I was sitting there having breakfast, and there was a big field in the background behind the dog. And I can remember the dog barking at me as if like he wanted to come inside. And I didn't really, you know, remember that until eventually a few, you know, decades later, I thought about that moment. And I asked my mom, I was like, hey, you know, was that were we ever at a place that looked exactly like this and had a little dog and some fields in the background? And she was like, yeah, actually that was, you know, one of her cousin's house or whatever it was. And so that's some of my earliest memory. But I would say that a lot of what motivates me when it comes to building the farm is actually kind of the culture upon which I grew up in, the culture of my grandparents and parents who came here with absolutely nothing, you know, in the early 50s, essentially, you know, after the war, after Italy was kind of decimated a little bit, was still trying to rebound and get back on its feet after World War II. They decide to move to a country where they know nobody. They don't speak the language. You know, here in Montreal, it's French and English. So they have some understanding of the mix, let's say, between Italian and French. And still to this day, my grandmother, who's still alive, still doesn't speak French or English, has some basic understanding of some basic words. But at the end of the day, you know, they always grew their own food. They were always super sustainable in their own way. They always kind of found a way to turn everything that they had access to, everything that they bought, every plastic container, they found ways to reuse it. They found ways to recycle it. They found ways to kind of sustain their life and build a wealth, you know, the life of the dream, in a sense, American dream, right? So they went from poverty to essentially, you know, the middle class in a generation, which is amazing. And so for me, I've always been motivated by that background, by that culture, by the fact that my grandmother grows her own food and makes her own tomato sauce and makes her own dough and makes her own pasta and makes her own everything. I just found that fascinating, and I find it very liberating to think about. And I also find it very heartwarming. And so that's always motivated me.
Well, how old are you now? You seem fairly
32.
Young.
32. Oh, okay. I'm going to be 33. Yeah.
Yeah, I was a kid till I was 40, everybody. But, you know, it's about, yeah, about that time. I think it was about 35, 36. So you get in the last half of the 30s, you kind of go, okay, I think I'm starting to see a pattern here in life. You know, I'm getting, you know, and you're still, and you know, the energy of being, you know, early 30s. Oh, if you're going to do it, now's the time. And if it's been 9 years, that means in your early 20s, you were doing this.
I was. Yeah.
What the hell? What class did they have on that? You know, how
did it?
And this is before. Yeah. What would that put it? 10, you know, so you probably had access to some videos and so on like that. It, you know, there's a little bit, but I'm telling you, it's just been in the last couple of years that people have starting to really, you know, make use of the, what they learned on the internet, what they developed, some techniques and different kind of materials and so on. And, cause it wasn't there. I've been looking for a long time. And in the last couple of years, it's sort of a, boom, we're going to moon base it out in the middle of we can, and y'all can suck it. So this, the tech is there. It's the social part of it. So when you started this, how did you acquire the land? Who was the first group of people who shared the dream?
Really, it was me and my father. My father had this kind of vision, you know, he had a kind of a midlife crisis when his father was dying. His father had been making wine for, you know, for years, every single year. And for generations, really, in our family, there's always been winemaking and stuff going on. And my father's father, so my grandfather, was getting sick. and he really didn't have the energy to really make any more wine. And so my dad decided that he wanted to get into it. So he looked around, we looked at properties in the area. We wanted to maybe start a vineyard. And he had this project in mind where they were going to kind of transform a golf course that was kind of not doing so well, and then buy all the land around the golf course, build housing project mixed with 90% of the land being used for a vineyard, and then building a big communal transformation center, a big vineyard, essentially, at the center of it. So the goal was to build kind of a business and a vineyard and a fully operating vineyard where each house would have a stake in the vineyard because their backyard would be vineyards. And then they would all kind of collaborate to make their wine, and everyone can share in the resources of all of that stuff. So that was my dad's vision.
But there's going to be group ownership. It wasn't going to be like
group ownership,
you know, farm hands or something, right?
Yeah, yeah. Group ownership. I mean, the farmhands, like, you know, if you owned the house and you didn't want to be a farmer and you were an accountant, for example, then you'd pay, you know, you'd pay some of the farmers and some of the people who manage and operate the business. That, you know, there would kind of be like a share that you had in the business. And depending on how much energy or time or money or whatever it is, you would have a different stake essentially in how much wine was produced, or what the value of that wine looked like from your farm or your plot, in a sense, right? That was kind of the idea. I mean, it never ended up happening. My dad ended up going to Vermont and building a vineyard there, and he's still operating that and doing stuff there, kind of part-time. He's a full-time lawyer and part-time vineyard owner, and he has a team and all that stuff. So he went off and did that. But what ended up happening is that the project got stopped because the government said, well, what happens, you know, our goal, one of the government agencies, essentially in Canada, which is a ton of red tape, they're known as the CPTLQ, which, you know, basically stands for, they're there to protect farming land, right? So they said, well, what happens if the vineyard fails? Now, all of a sudden, we made you, allowed you guys to build a bunch of mansions, vineyard fails. Now, all this land that was a farm, now it's all residential. And what about that? And so the project gets kind of stopped, and I decide, well, wait a second. What does it take to be a farmer? Like, what are the requirements for being a farmer? So what if we built a farmer's co-op where even if one farm fails, well, the co-op and the grouping of farmers coming together could continue. And there's real value in that. And so what I discovered is that to be a farmer in Canada, or at least in Quebec, you only need $5,000 of revenue a year to register as a farmer, which allows you to then build farm-related buildings on your property. That looks like greenhouses. That looks like irrigation systems. That looks like a fruit stand, or, you know, some kind of welcome.
You know, I love all these numbers. How the hell do they come up with these numbers? $5,000, you're a farmer. I mean, you know, I whatever. Okay, so they got some requirements. You go through and you check off all these whatever. Go ahead and finish with that. I just want to make that comment. $5,000, sure. Why not 10? Why not 2? Why not, I got a garden. Why not kiss my butt? It's my land.
I agree. I mean, Long story short, their goal is to kind of maintain farmland being farmland, residential being residential. So they have some hoops and hurdles and things that are there for that.
But why do they that's one thing. Let's talk about that a second. We got time.
Yeah.
Here in America, you know, they have agricultural tax, you know, levels and this and that and so on to try and just make it to where you have to use your land to produce enough to be able to pay the taxes. You know, and then you go, well, I don't want to, I just want to do a garden. I don't want to have to, like, you know, go to the market and sell stuff and be a farmer. I don't want to have to worry about production. I just want to sustain my own life, live on my property, and then your business. And they go, nah, we think you should, you know, a little something, something for the home team here or something, you know? Yep. And I'm so these numbers and these requirements.
Well, here's the answer.
Canada says they want to promote farms.
Well,
is that really what they're trying to do?
If you're growing your own food and you're eating your own food, you're not necessarily buying food, and therefore you're not participating in what is a taxable event. When I buy food at the grocery store, right now, obviously some foods are non-taxed, at least in Canada. But if I buy anything with sugar, if I buy anything processed, if I buy anything, whatever, I'm paying a tax. And if I sell things, I also charge a tax and pay the tax in a sense back to the system. Obviously, if people are empowered and you know, running their own homestead, essentially, is what you're saying, then they're not participating in taxable events, and therefore that is less attractive.
Even at a low amount of $5,000 has guaranteed that you're not just farming to sustain your family. You're having to produce something to pay or make a minimum you got to fill out some paperwork. I mean, you know, I'm just, you know, they're socially and economically engineering down to the small subsistence farmer of 5,000. I mean, just by even having that on the books, ink on paper, they're already preventing the very thing that they were supposed to, you know, be supporting.
Protecting in a sense. Yes. To some degree. Yes. And the key there is that, you know, all of these government agencies are made up of people who are trying to find, just do their job. Right. They didn't necessarily make the rules. They're just trying to do their job. And do I agree with their job? Do I agree with the rules? No, not all the time. But I also respect that. I understand that they are just, you know, functional workers just doing what they have to do so they can go home to their family and live their life and do their thing. And so that's great. You know, is it enraging and infuriating at times? Absolutely. But if you understand the system, then you can work with it. Because there's really amazing loopholes that come with being a farmer. Like, number one, taxes on farmland or taxes as a farmer is cheaper than taxes if I had a residential property. So right next door, our farm is an 88-acre property. It's 20 minutes away from downtown Montreal. So where I'm sitting right now, I'm in downtown Montreal in the old port of Montreal. 20 minutes away, that's where our farm is. And it borders suburbia. Now, bordering suburbia means million-dollar homes, massive, you know, two-acre properties, 1.5-acre properties with, you know, beautiful, beautiful homes. And their house and their homes are taxed at a certain rate, whereas our farm is taxed at a significantly lower rate for two reasons. One, ours is agricultural, theirs is residential. Two, because I'm a farmer, I can apply for tax credits as a farmer that as long as I farm the land in some way, shape, or form, and I made $5,000 of revenue, I can apply for a 70% tax credit if I'm a non-organic farmer or an 85% tax credit if I'm an organic farmer, certified organic. Great. So we're an all natural farm. I say all natural because, to be very political here, we're not organic because we're not certified organic, but everything we do is organic. We have no, we
you know, they keep, I went through this with the organic thing and they just keep redefining what organic means.
Oh, sure. You know? And organic doesn't necessarily mean better. I mean, you could still use conventional farming practices and have all kinds of waste and water problems and issues. I mean, it's
No, it depends what they define, you know, and that's why I like calling it virgin food. You know, you didn't screw with it. You know, no. I'll just, you know, Uncle Sam or, you know, what are your version of Uncle Sam? I just want to put the tip in, you know, we're just going to do it a little bit. No, it's virgin or it's not, you know? Yeah. So but they do this classification. Is there a clipboard guy with a shiny badge and the always available gun coming around checking?
Of course. Yeah, to some degree. I mean, if you're trying to be certified organic, then they're going to come and check your processes. And every once in a while, they're going to try and drop in and see what's going on or whether or not you're following those practices or not. And if there's evidence that
they announce or they just come.
I mean, I haven't tried the certification personally because I don't care to because I don't care to do more paperwork. Honestly, I don't want them to show up. So it's not worth
how much more percentage do I pay in taxes than I don't have
15%, which is irrelevant, immaterial for me. So I'm not focused personally on the farm being only about growing food. It's also about growing community and all the things that go around that. You know,
unless paperwork helps that.
Absolutely. But over the years, what I've done is I've went to many various intentional communities all over the globe. So whether it be in Peru or Argentina or New Hampshire or Massachusetts or whatever it is, I went to different eco villages all over the globe. And eco villages is, you know, villages that are intentional communities. I don't always love the term. But the point is, I went to these different villages and I start to learn what works and what doesn't. What makes a community fail? What makes a community work? And what starts to get in the way? And then how do you actually earn a living? And what I learned a lot about when I went to Israel, Palestine, whichever one you want to call it, is that many of the kibbutzes there, which are kind of intentional communities, have been around for decades. They tend to have a core business at the center of it. And most of the problems that come up, as you were talking about, are either social or financial, right? The two things that kill communities, or the two things that kill businesses, by the way, startups, is the people don't get along and they start to disagree, or they don't run out of resources and they don't have enough and they can't continue, right? So those two factors, I started to recognize that most eco villages or most permaculture farms are making money, more money teaching how to grow or teaching how to build a community or teaching how to do permaculture than they were actually doing permaculture. And the reason for that is simple. To grow or to make $1,000 growing tomatoes, you have to grow what? 3,000 tomatoes plus maybe? to make $1,000 teaching how to grow tomatoes, you maybe have to sell one or two courses depending on what price point you have. You know what I mean? So you have to have one or two people be interested in something like that. And then they come in, they pay money, they do the course, and you know, there you go. So obviously the question becomes, when building and creating a farm, what is farming? What isn't? Am I doing this interview talking about the farm farming? Right? Am I a farmer by promoting the farm and doing some of the work that required that is required for us to grow our brand and grow our farm? I mean, any farm has a brand. I mean, you can think of some farm brands, can't you? Right. So at the end of the day, there's work to be done both in the field and in, you know, behind a desk sometimes or behind a camera sometimes. So
when you say here, practical educational site focused on sustainable solutions relating to blah, 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 you know, you're like, we've built a really good example, and we'd be more productive teaching others to have such an example of what we got here and make more revenue.
It's not just productive. No, it's not really a productivity thing. We're one of the closest eco-villages that I know of to a city center on the planet. Most of the villages that in places that you're talking about, what you know, some people love to call these pockets of freedom, tend to be an hour plus out of a city, right? Mm-hmm. So they're 2 hours here or this way or that way, but we're literally right next to suburbia. Like we are.
But you're not in city limits. Are you in
no,
Canada?
If you were to consider the you know, when you look at New York, you can include Brooklyn and New Jersey or whatever it is, whatever you include, Queens or whatever.
You're part of the metropolitan area.
We are part of the metropolitan of Montreal. Therefore, we have to respect many of the guidelines. They're stricter, obviously, than if we were an hour and a half in the bush or whatever. So,
well, see, this is, I just want to get, you know, difference between U.S. and Canada. In the United States, you have, you know, a small community, some kind of a township, you know, a town, a city, whatever the hell, a municipality. You're inside a geographic area you vote for, whatever. Yep. Then you have the county. You know, which is a political subdivision of the state, you know, and then you got the federal. So where you're at, you have Montreal, the city, and what do they call counties?
So counties are said they're basically it's another way of saying county. I mean, the correct English term would be county. So we're in, you know, Montreal as a whole, the island is the city of Montreal with a bunch of different boroughs, right? They call them boroughs here. So the boroughs are there. On the south shore of Montreal, which is where the farm is, there's a big borough called Longueuil. It's a French word, but it's called Longueuil. So most of the town is part of Longueuil. And where we're part of is a borough right next to Longueuil, which is called Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu. Now, the name of the town we're in is called Saint-Luc. The name of the borough is called Saint-Jean. The name of the city that we're in, generally, the agglomeration is Montreal. But we don't necessarily pay – we really focus on Saint-Jean law. And we're in the state or the province in Canada, it's called, of Quebec. And then within that, we're in Canada.
Okay, so Montreal, I'm sure, the social and the influence and the, you know, the TV programming and, you know, thou shalt and whatever is Montreal. But I'm still wondering, you're not dealing with a Montreal shiny badge of voting for the city council of whatever of Montreal.
No. We are not dealing with Montreal. We are dealing with Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu, and we're dealing with the Quebec government, the Quebec provincial government.
Okay. See, this is the reason I want to bring this. I want to break this down is because this is what, for me, is the problem. It's always the county. You know, it's always if you're outside of some municipality, all right, fine. You know, what's the state law? Well, it doesn't really matter because it's county by county of whether you got to have a building permit or in some counties you can get a permit to not have to get any more permits. I'm like, what? You know, so there's all kinds of different things. In some places in Missouri, they don't give
a different
crap,
everywhere. It's different everywhere. And that's why there's no one size fits all solution. But what I'll say is that farming and the rights around farming tend to be quite liberal, more liberal than anything else. It's a game. Obviously, for me to pay to do the paperwork and pay the taxes and do all that stuff, you always have some element of that game because you're within the United States or you're within Canada or you're within some.
No, in Arizona, it's the same. You get agricultural status on the land. You pay a lot less in property taxes. Yeah. And, you know, where's my goat? Okay.
The benefit becomes, well, then you say, okay, but if it's agricultural, then I can't build houses on it. Well, that's not true, right? That's not true if you're a farmer. So if you're a full-time farmer, you can build your house. You can build the house of any family member. So let's say I had kids and my kids grow up and I can build their house. Or if my parents are getting older and I want to build a house for them, I can build their house. And I can build the housing of full-time farm workers. Okay, well, what does a full-time farm worker look like? And what are the rules around that? And the answer is it's revenue. That's it. So I could say, you come to our community. I say, hey, guess what? Start joining in, start participating in the farm. Don't have another job, at least under your personal name, your legal personal, you know, corporation entity, right? We won't get into that. But the point being, don't pay personal taxes on anything other than farming revenue. And then let's up your farming revenue. Well, how do you do that? Well, we could do that in anything. I can exchange your services and I can pay you whatever price per hour that I would have for you to go shovel out and dig a trench, right? There's no limit to how much I pay you to dig a trench. There's no limit to how much I pay you to pick tomatoes. So I could just rise your revenue. You become a farmer and now all of a sudden you do what you got to
do. Okay. Now you're in for your particular, it'll change in different places, but it's going to be a lot the same.
It's very similar when we get,
I'm sorry.
It's very similar in many places.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be very similar when we start getting into the social aspects of who.
Oh, absolutely. Social is the same.
But when your primary revenue stream comes from the farm, then in the way that you do it, are they employees of a trust? Is it a company that they work for? Are they, you know, partners in it? I mean, how did
so that's why we opened up a cooperative. When we first started, we actually started with a nonprofit because I thought that was a way that we can kind of go through the system in an
paperwork.
Yeah, no. So I was not down for doing the paperwork of that. I mean, the tax benefits and sure. I think it's better to be a farming cooperative. Now, what a cooperative means is that everyone who owns a share of the cooperative, meaning they're a member of the cooperative through the social stuff of the how you join a membership is another story. Let's talk about legal first, right? The legal side of it is once you become a member of a cooperative, you are actually an owner of the farm business. Now, how you have membership structures, you can build different membership tiers. So what we did is we did worker members, producer members, and supporter members. Supporter members is the simplest one. I like the farm. I'm interested in financially participating in it and helping out. I want to be able to come and, you know, show up to some of the workshops. I want to have, access to growing my food or doing things, but I don't necessarily live on site or, I'm not, maybe I live nearby. I'm just supporting and I become a member, but I still get a vote. A producer member is saying, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a self-made farmer. I want to grow garlic or I want to make honey. Great. I want to do that, but I don't necessarily have access to land. Or even if I do, I want access to this land. So I want to come and work in conjunction with you guys, but still have my own revenue and just pay my dues as a member and a producer. Great. And a worker is somebody who's fully employed by the cooperative to do whatever it is that the cooperative needs doing, some of which could be common tasks like cutting the grass or, taking care of the machinery or, dealing with the tourists that come or the people who visit the farm. I don't know. Whatever those jobs look like, we can hire and employ those people directly as a cooperative. So what a cooperative is a legal entity that is kind of on the farm. It rents the farm in a sense or uses the farm, but the farm or the underlying asset is owned by whoever the landlord, if you want to use those words, is. Now, in my case or in our case, I'm one of the landlords. My father's the other investor. So my father and I came together. We bought this land. Slowly but surely, I'm buying more and more of it from him in a sense. And our goal is to build a 150-person community, 30 homes that fully self-sustains life on the farm. And now, why 150 people? I studied something called Dunbar's number, okay? Which is essentially they studied Native American tribes or tribes around the globe where what was the scale at which people can build community and maintain trust and maintain harmony? And the rough number, at least the theory around that, is that Dunbar's number is roughly the size of the number of people that you can maintain a bond of trust. Okay. You don't have to necessarily like them. You don't have to agree with them all the time, but you can trust their intentions. You can feel connected. You can feel like your voice is heard if there's conflict or, you know, problems or whatever it is, which we can get into later. Right. So that's the theory. The theory is, can we build a 150 person community, take this farm that was a former GMO corn and soy field, literally flat with absolutely nothing on it. Nothing would grow other than whatever, chemical,
Monsanto fruit,
exactly. That's what was growing there for 20 plus years easy. Okay. We transformed that into a permaculture farm and a market garden. So permaculture is more a long-term vision. It's like planting, like as you would see in a forest, right? In a forest, there's not rows of tomatoes. There's maybe tomatoes growing next to asparagus and basil. If you're really lucky, you're in a forest and you find that, great. But the idea is in permaculture is that certain plants and certain ecosystems have different functions, right? Like trees grow high, bushes grow medium, and then you've got crawlers that grow low. So in our case, we do, you know, strawberries on the ground, berry bushes on the middle range, and then we have fruit trees at the top. And that creates a scenario where there's ecosystem that functions, that helps one another, keeps humidity in the soil, and that allows itself to have less and less human input. That's the point, right?
Yeah, so that's, you know, and you can select, we've gone through a lot of this. You select different trees that may even be three different versions of peaches, but they all ripen within a week of each other. So
yes,
you're not having to pick the entire freaking thing.
Build diversity.
Stage it, yeah.
Yeah, and that diversity could be good for your lifestyle because you just want different peaches, or that diversity could be good if you're trying to, you know, materialize this and turn it into money or into other products, then you can do that too. For me,
or I don't want to have to eat 400 bushels of the same kind of peach in a week.
At all, right, in the same time. Yes, you absolutely. Know,
so I get that the technical aspects of it is interesting, and it really comes down to, this is what I'm finding, anyone that has been successful in this or any longevity whatsoever, you've gone your 5 years, you're in the nine, has been, it always comes down, and you know, the place is called Matria Mountain Village. Okay. And this Articles of Association 4. Now, this is Northern California, and the one thing that I'm already getting to tell from what you're talking about, what, because this is the first time I've seen something written down.
Sure.
If you got something written down, I want that too, you know?
Absolutely.
And because these guys up here talking about that, I go, well, what's your plan? Well, we'll figure it out on a, man, no, hell no. We ain't doing that, you know? I'm investing money. I want to know what's up. So I'm looking at, when I see these articles, it comes down to somebody owns it. It always does. It always comes down to the buck stops here. Freaking
But the way the system currently operates is that somebody has to own the land, therefore be accountable to the law. So therefore something has to happen. Now, that somebody could be an entity, right? The co-op could buy the farm
or whatever.
Or it could be a trust, or it could be whatever. In an ideal scenario, I believe at the beginning stages of building a community, you do want what I would consider to be, and my friend Stephen Brooks, who builds, he's been running a permaculture farm and eco-village out in Costa Rica for literally 24 years now, okay? 24, 25 years. He says best, a benevolent dictatorship at the beginning really works well. Here's why. At the beginning, everything is new and novel, and the direction at which you're going to grow is organic, right? It's kind of a duocracy of sorts, right? Yes, the ideal of having a sociocracy or having one person, one vote, all that kind of stuff, which comes with a co-op and the legal structures of that thing, is great, but it's very difficult to get going because, just like any startup, if you don't have some form of leadership and you don't have some form of direction, it tends to fall apart. Yeah. So you need very clear, specific, you know, values, which is what I call the collective flag. That's the name Valhalla and what it stands for, which we call freedom culture, to empower and encourage all individuals to spread their unique gifts to the world. Great. That's a nice vague way of saying we believe in these things and we believe in freedom. We believe in that. But freedom is different for every single person. So how do we find a common vision, specific mission that we can all rally around and continuously hold as the next checkpoint in our community? For us, it's 150 person community, 30 homes, fully functioning farm, fully functioning ecosystem that enables two things, your personal ROI and our collective ROI, return on investment, ripple of impact. You need to be self-empowered. Why? What happens in 3 years if somehow all of a sudden you were dating somebody in the community, you guys divorce, and one of them wants to leave, right? Or both of them want to leave. Well, you need to find ways to create, you know, in the world of crypto, fungibility, right? Non-fungible tokens, fungibility. You need to be able to have people come and go when they want. Here and there, they want to travel. Here and there, they have a different life beat. Here and there, somebody goes bankrupt or becomes an addict. I don't know what happens. The point is that things happen in life, and you need to be able to create a system where people interface with a collective body, in our case, the co-op, and their individual, you know, merits. Great. That's your business. That's why the producer member is such a phenomenal way of going about this, because we can say, anybody can show up and say, I want to be a farmer. And I'm like, great. Prove it. Prove it. I'm not going to fund you. I don't have to do everything. Here's the land. Here's the agreements you have with the co-op. Here's the things that you can do. Here's the things you can't do, right? Like, you can't trample my crop while making yours. Simple agreements. Sometimes some of them are more nuanced than others. Long story short is, if you make money, then you make money. If you don't make money, then you don't make money. And that's up to you. So we're going to do all the things we can to support you. We're obviously going to share certain communal things like the tractor or the shovel or different things. And hopefully we can also support you in the brand and in attracting an audience or attracting people. Because one of the biggest challenges with farming is that those who farm successfully don't have enough time to sell it. So they don't really make the money. They just kind of sell it wherever they can. They tend to sell it in big batches. But if you can attract the customer to the farm, you're actually maximizing the opportunity that you have as a farmer. Plus, you're saving an enormous amount of time that it takes to chop it, clean it, bring it somewhere, stand at the farmer's market and do all those different things, right? So in our case, we're such a unique community because we're so close to the city, but we also have so many people who show up for educational purposes who are interested in talking to me. I mean, look, you're talking to me from New Hampshire. How the hell do you figure out about us? Now, I know that it was because we're on a panel. The point being, all of that comes from there's a lot of people we're really interested in what we're doing, and we always have more demand than we have supply. And when you're in the business of having more demand than you have supply, you'll always keep your lights on or your solar generator on or whatever it is, right? The point is you're going to find a way to continuously grow. And so that really is why our community has functioned, is that we have some degree of entrepreneurship. At the end of the day, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a storyteller. I've run marketing agencies. I've used my understanding of brand building to move us forward, to kind of build a face and a brand that allows us people to understand what we do and why we do it. But most importantly, we can back it up with the thing that we are actually doing. Now, in year one, we weren't backing it up because it was a GMO cornfield. So everything we planted was dying or not really working. But now in year nine, when you come and you're like, oh, wow, the abundance is beginning, because the tree that we planted in year one, which was a two-year-old tree, was only going to start producing in 5, 6, 7 years. Well, guess what? Now we're at that point where those trees are producing. So again, it's less about how much money we're selling or how much money we're making off the trees. It's really about the brand and the ecosystem that comes with that and the value that comes with building a community of intentional people. Because how many people in the world of business pay to join a mastermind where they can meet like-minded people and find like an interesting talent? And that in and of itself is super, super, super interesting to people. It's also a place where people can gather. It's a place where we can do farm table dinners. It's a place where we can, you know, sell products. It's a place where we can do yoga. It's a place where somebody can host an event or a wedding. I mean, so we're very diverse in our capacity and our ability to essentially enable the individual entrepreneurship or the individual gifts and talents of people so that they can be self-empowered to walk away whenever they want to walk away, or double down if they want to double down. And that's beautiful. That's you need a balance between the old system of economics and the new system of community. And I say new system. It's really an old system. But
yeah, when you say the system of community, let me ask some specific questions. You're 9 years into this. You've had probably
every challenge you could think of.
Yeah, every freaking whatever's happened in the first 3 years. But, but with 9 years, this is what happens. Have you had families that come with children?
Of course.
This is what you want. You're trying to build. You got young people coming in. You know, you're either married or going to be or have children or already have or something, right? So do you have children?
I don't.
Okay, so this is a good question. You come in. They have the cutest, nicest, sweetest little preteen 10 to 12-year-old girl, boy, whatever. And then it's 9 years later, you know, they're 18, 19, 20, whatever. And they're freaking got the 2-stroke dirt bike of I got it and I'm, you know, testosterone, you know, then what? I mean, you know, I mean, it takes a eco village to raise your kid. I mean, I'm just, you know, how do you deal with these kinds of problems? Where's your jail? I mean, you know.
I think the number one thing that we use to our advantage is time, right? Like, how do we accept members? One, I don't do a 5-hour boot camp because anybody can play nice for 5 hours, but it's different to play nice for 5 months. It's different to play nice for a year, right? It's different to see because anybody can talk for a little while and say, yeah, I'm going to do the thing. And then for a few months, do the thing. But then all of a sudden they drop off the face of the planet. And now all of a sudden they said they were going to take care of the bees, but they're not taking care of the bees. So two things that we work with. One, you are financially accountable to your own projects. If your bee project fails, and it's your money. It's the easiest way to keep accountability is to put people.
You don't have a cooperative treasury of I vote somebody else's money for my project.
I mean, no, not really. Okay, what we have is a benevolent dictatorship to some degree. I'm the biggest investor. I put in money to a lot of communal projects all the time. Now, I'm not the only one who has done that, but some people say, hey, I really like this communal project. I'll put money into that. I'd love to see it operate in this way. I'd love to go in that direction. Other people say, I really kind of want to do a little bit of my own thing. I want to take care of the chickens. Great. Take care of the chickens. You make the revenue from the chickens. Now, if you want us, the community, to sell your eggs, then there's a fee, and that fee is standard across the board. So if you want us to do certain things, great, we can do that. If it's only selling it, there's the fee. If it's us doing it for you, then we're not going to do it for you because we're going to do it ourselves. So we're not trying to creating a scenario where people can just show up with money and have a stake in it, because the people who do are the people who gain. And that's what we focus
on. You made a good point. I think shouldn't be glossed over as quickly. This is where the power comes in a community like this, is somebody that's negotiating with the outside for your productivity, your widgets, your rocking chairs, your product, your whatever. You know, so this is it the company that does that? Is it just, you know, learned individuals that are making these contacts with distributors and, you know, food to table kind of thing? I mean, how's that work and how's it evolve?
It works in two ways. One, there's more demand than there is supply. That's why it works. First of all, there's everything we grow, we can sell at the end of the day. Now, I'm not trying to say that every plant that we put in the ground survives or every plant doesn't get eaten.
No. That's the point that I'm talking about. If I have a demand and I'm going, hey, you're taking too big a cut, I'll just sell at the, you know, Fred's distributor market of whatever, which I'm sure they probably could do. But you've developed a relationship and business ties and so on that they'd rather deal with somebody that's consistent. And that's why with a co-op, you have productivity over here. This guy got good chickens. These die. This works, doesn't work. So you have a branding, a reputation in Montreal to where they're going to Valhalla.
Yes. And that reputation is still young. As a farm, we haven't sold or produced an enormous amount just yet, but we're getting more and more productive every single year. Literally, our garlic production has, you know, doubled or tripled every single year. And over time, people want it. Now, the fastest thing for me, from an economic perspective, I want to spend as little time selling and as much time growing and producing and doubling as possible from the land use perspective. Why? Well, because you're either doing a really good job selling or you're doing a really good job growing. I'd rather focus on growing better, because that means that longer term visions come to fruition. Transforming the soil. Farming is about soil at the end of the day, okay? Everyone thinks about the tomatoes, but it's not about the tomatoes. It's about the health of your soil. Because if you have healthy soil, you can make tomatoes. But if you don't have healthy soil, it's going to cost you more and more money to continuously try and make those tomatoes. So we focus on certain principles that we teach and we learn, and we learn through doing. See, I'm not going to believe someone that comes up to me and says, hey, I have no farming experience, but I want to grow 10,000 tomatoes this year. I'd be like, great. Good luck. You're going to learn all these lessons. But in the meantime, we'll help you. You're going to put your time, energy, sweat, equity. You're going to do it. And if you fail, you fail. But if you succeed, even better. Our goal is to give you the conditions to succeed. Not everyone succeeds, just like not every tree that we plant survives. But some of them do. And as you do that over time, it gets better and better and better and better. And you have to be able, in the meantime, to sustain all the expenses of the farm. Now, the expenses of the farm are super low. It's not that expensive to own land, pay the taxes, which is what, $2,000 a year for 80 plus acres? Great. And at the end of the day, we don't really have that many common expenses. We have insurance expense and we have some power expenses, only now because this year, for the first time, we brought in city power. Now, the only reason for that is because we have more people living at the farm or at the farm at the moment, and we're in the flux of installing more solar panels. So essentially, the way I'm operating is 1 foot in the system, 1 foot out of the system. The system goes down, we have all our own power, water, food, everything. The system doesn't go down, we still have our power, water, food, and everything, and we can benefit from the system when we need it, if we need it, right? So it's a game of balance, and I'm...
You know, solar's getting so freaking cheap, and of course, Arizona, you know, it's, you know, we probably need half the panels you do.
But Montreal's one of the sunniest places on the planet. I mean, we have less sunlight in certain times of the year based on the fact that we're a little further north. But at the same time, in winter, panels are super efficient because of light bounces off the snow and then goes onto the panels in certain cases, depending on the angle.
So what kind of battery storage are you using?
We have kind of a lithium ion system, a kind of 6-volt deep battery systems, almost very similar to what you'd have in RVs or probably in the Love Bus. That's our battery system at the moment. Once we're building kind of a communal house on the farm now, and that's kind of my house, but it is my house, but it's also designed with the idea of hosting retreats, workshops, a bunch of other things involved. So it's designed for transformation of products. It's designed for massive dinners. It's designed to essentially house the people who are running the project at the end of the day. Long story short, that house will have, you know, Powerwall or a Tesla system. That house will have a bigger battery system. So what you're doing is you're always kind of moving the needle by advancing. Okay, you always need food, power, water, toilets, and shade. Those are the five things you need to do well and stay on the farm as long as possible. The longer you're on the farm, the more boots are on the ground, the more things happen at the farm. The more things happen at the farm, the more we produce, the better the community, the more people show up, the more we produce. Nah, 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 nah. You have to understand.
And then you multiply the problems too. But, you know, I have a pretty good bead on. We've been doing a lot of the stuff. We lived it for 10 years on our 2-acre property in the desert. And on the bus, we do have lithium iron phosphate. We got Battleborn, you know, batteries, 400 amp hours of that at 12 volts. And we've got, I think it's a 3,500 inverter charge controllers, 800 watts on the roof, 480 that I can pull out from underneath the bus. And the goal was, can we run no sun off grid without doing the generator for at least 2 days? You know, I wanted to be able to, you know, have enough power to run the show and the live and the lights, you know, all the, you know, refrigerator and everything.
Yep.
So that was really the goal. That was the standard. It's really been working out pretty well, especially with the diesel backup generator. I mean, I just turn on the generator and, you know, in a couple hours and it's charged. So lithium iron phosphate is just getting dirt cheap. The solar panels are getting dirt cheap. You know, the charge controller and the inverters and the all that's coming in one unit, you know, the deck of cards eventually of, oh, my God. I mean, it's just technology is getting – energy is not really the problem anymore.
Nope.
Water – rain harvesting is a big thing. There's a lot of freaking water you can get from rain. And then, if, God forbid, you have a well, you're done, you know, and it produces good water. So that means you can have, you know, with power and water, you can do food.
Yep.
Problem with me has been two things. It's how you socially set up the community is what we're talking about today, and communication. It's internet. We had up here, Rogers Campground up near the Canadian border in New Hampshire has stuck for internet. I mean, it's just been, people come up in the early years and they go, woo! I don't have any connection. If I can't use my phone, I guess I got to actually talk to people. What the hell, you know?
Yeah.
They were so enamored with the fact
that that's getting solved.
Well, then it starts getting better. This year was the cell services were probably better than most. But a friend of mine, you know, our IT guy, Derek Slopey from Agorist Hosting brought in a Starlink. And then he said, well, I live over there now. So it would, you know, geographically turn on. And then he put a mesh network around and we're running, you know, 40, 100 megabytes up, down, doing, when the hell have we ever had that at a Porcupine Freedom Festival, you know?
Well, that's it. The Starlink and satellite, low orbit satellite internet is changing the game. It's going to change the ability for people to be outside of the city and go and still live in the bush, but earn a city living. And that is a system of abundance. That system of abundance will eventually correct itself into a state of level state, essentially. But the point is that having internet is a great way of importing resource, right? Because then I can do a job online, bring in resource that imports into the farm so that as I'm importing more and more and more into the farm, then the farm is going to grow. It's just, everything boils down to basic economics.
It's the communicating to be able to sell what you do. I mean, you know, it's having markets. And so, see, this is the other thing. David Friedman was a speaker up here. He stopped by the site here, and we were just yakking it. And in the conversation, I could see it kind of, you know, took him back a little bit. And the point that I was making, I'm going, you have all of the rural areas are being represented in all these shows. You know, people, right. They give their perspective because they got fiber optic. You know, I mean, whoever's there being able to share daily and upload, like I was doing 3 hours of video a day. And all I did my whole life, I'm sitting there watching, you know, little wheel spin, the little hourglasses, I'm loading whatever. Oh, screw that. So people that are out in the rural areas, their voice isn't heard. Sure as hell not on par with the sheer volume of what's coming out of the urban areas.
Of course.
With communication of ones and zeros, you're able from your facility and others all around the world, they mm-hmm. get to share and have their experiences, how their life is, what they're doing from their perspective, how they want, you know, the government to leave them alone and be gone. And this is going to change everything. And I don't think people realize the socioeconomic alteration that that's going to bring when the rural America, North America, the world, they get to have an opinion.
I fully agree. It's going to change the real estate game, too. You know, everything is going to shift when we have more and more access to any technology or any capacity to essentially be further out, but still doing the things that you were doing back in the city. And so with better solar tech and better wind tech and better battery systems, you're going to have better grid and better resiliency. With better communication systems, you're going to have more, like you said, access to the market, or at least access to information. You're going to have access to, selling your products or selling your services. So all of those things are going to democratize freedom more and more and more. Now, the question is, they also take away your freedom. They also limit your freedom in some way, shape, or form. Now, part of that is because there's psychological warfare that goes down on Facebook or Instagram or whatever it is. Now, part of that is also because we're letting that happen at the end of the day, too. So where's the line, right? Where's the line between your own systems and different things? Well, I think things like crypto and the technology of blockchain is very interesting. I think it enables ownership, for example, of a co-op share or membership to be something very interesting. You can build economics differently because now you can remove some of the middlemen that used to play the role of banker, used to play the role of insurer, used to play the role when you sell a land, you have to go to a notary, right? Accountants. You can create better systems of accounting, better systems of agreements, better systems of legal, better systems of ownership and taking notes and a registry of sorts. All of that can be solved by the blockchain. And all you need is a freaking internet access. That means you need power. That means you need internet. So that is happening. And that is the most disruptive of forces for building community, sustainable eco-villages, community of all types and shapes and kinds. Some of that applies to building land-based projects like we're talking about, but that also applies to technology where Silicon Valley and all of the energy that's coming out of that, all the productivity that's coming out of that can now be in Utah. So guess what? Places like Boise, Idaho, or Utah are booming in real estate because now people can be there and still do the things that they and still have the opportunity they had or only would have had if they were in New York City or in San Francisco or in Austin, Texas, or wherever it is.
So this is, you know, if you're going to have a – see, this is the one thing that we've been thinking a lot about. For me, I'm going, man, if it's not about property rights, mine, I'll be a great neighbor. You know, sure. If I need to make sure that, you know, I'm in a place where I got – great neighbors, or they appreciate a great neighbor or something.
Sure.
And so if I get some land, I'm thinking the 2 acres that we farmed and did and sustained on, that worked pretty good. You got power and water, 2 acres will do you. Okay. I mean, I don't need a big giant farm. I'm not looking to make a whole bunch of money.
I think the average farm and homestead for a small family, and I say small, like, you know, 5-6 members tops, you need about 1.5 to 2 acres, and that's more than
it
enough.
Seems to me that was, if you structure it well, because I don't need to be going way out. Man, if I need a freaking vehicle to go to the edge of my food, it's too far. I mean, I have it around you. And that design, so 2 acres, kind of, I'm like, okay, so I got 4 kids, 12 grandkids. Mm-hmm. I'm going, I need 10 acres. If that gives me five plots, I've, you know, left your kids and you got your 2 acre of pace, you know, I'm done, you know, I'm good. So I'm looking at, you know, it needs to be at least 10 acres for what I want to do. If I was going to do, I would think if it was 2 acres per family, that would be a good idea. So I'm looking at, I got 80 acres. All right. Yep. Well, I got 40 families, you know, or whatever. I'm, you know, just kind of a rough number. Yep. And then the Dunbar number you're talking about, this has been our experience in doing our freedom summits and different events over 30 years of me being an activist in the freedom, liberty community or whatever. It always goes, you need at least 80 people to make anything happen. And when you hit about 120, you probably get the most input. Everybody gets to talk to everybody. Everybody knows everybody. It gets over about 200. That's when you start having problems and splinters and
starts to break down.
So 150 seems like a pretty freaking good number to me. Okay. So I'm going, and there's a lot of life experiences and other research. And then up here at Porkfest over the last couple of years, they're screaming this number and everything. I'm going, yeah, that kind of comports to, you know, my life experiences. I get it. And I'm like, you know, you start researching why. Well, it's because that's the number of people that you can freaking remember their names. I mean, you know, you have investment of this personal relationship with them. You got, you know, at some point, you know, you're so like when you have these festivals, you come up here, you know, they start, you know, they're open up and parties and new people come in and introduced to whatever, but there's always, they have their cliques and different communities of communities and you get a community. Then the one thing that we're talking about is if we're doing this and we have some kind of structure, you know, there's a blockchain for that or an app, freedom. There's an app for that. I mean, you know, if you come in with some kind of criteria, then I wanted to be able, the idea kind of came up. I was thinking, I go, you know, my wife does not want to live in New Hampshire. I mean, she likes it. It's nice in the summer. She wants to be near the grandkids. And she was from Pennsylvania State College, Penn State, freaking snow. No, hell no. I smell snow. I'm leaving. I mean, you know, it's like
a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah, she don't want to deal with that. And I'm just like, it's technology, man. You put on the right kind of, you know,
you put layers. Yeah.
But the which is what I'm learning. As I was under the bus for 6 months in Maine, I mean, you know, you get the right clothes in the winter, I mean, that kind of thing. So I go, all right, what if we had an agreement or something that I'm signed into that I'm part of a cooperative of communities? I can spend X amount of months here. It's like Airbnb for freedom activists. I, you know, yes, and people want you to come there. There may be incentives because you're an ad, you got a backhoe, you're something that you bring to it. Talent. They want you to come. So I get you, Vahabi, Ernie, we need you to get your butt up here and do some whatever the hell. Okay. Yeah. Well, that competition between communities in North America would be awesome. It's like timeshare to where they're wanting you, you know, instead of you wanting that. So it's just interesting that we could do a lot of these different things. But a community itself, when it comes down to their autonomy and their control, the way that you're doing it, ultimately, it's a king's privy council if the buck stops freaking me, you know? And I'm wondering at that point when you have the nonviolent communication of the town meeting of the, you know, 99 point whatever percent of everybody versus you, you know, and the problem that I had, you know, with this one gentleman, he goes, what they did, Dan Schultz. And I wanted to look into here, and he said, Articles of Association. And he goes, yeah, I've seen where they've done trusts, and then they get voted off their own island.
That's definitely.
You know, so I'm making sure whatever the hell I'm doing, homie gets to be Lord God King Bufu of all I survey in the end, and it's mine. You know, now what my neighbors or the community I go in, well, then you're looking at, you know, articles of incorporation of the municipality of the city of, I mean, you start going down, you know, that road. So yours from the beginning, you had the vision of we're going to have how many homes, 130, you said, or
30 homes, 30. 150 people,
150 people. So 30 homes, you said, this is the goal. We have the land for this goal. We have the resources, people that can, hell, they can drive the work, you know, but they, you know, some family members, somebody's got to be doing some farming for them to get the benefits of whatever, which is government, social and economic engineering. I'm not digging that, but
sure.
You know, you have the benefits of being, you know, in a municipality. So what you really want is not to comply with the law. What you want is you want to be able to have a community that gets along with each other, that's self-sustaining, that doesn't have to pay a whole bunch of taxes, that you get so that you can live this rural agrarian kind of sustain yourself. Oh my God, I got a business life.
And still have control over your own, and still have control over your own island. Meaning, if you're one of the houses and you have a little 2-acre property, let's say, on the farm, that's your island. You still have control of it. I'm not going to have control of your island. I'm not going to dictate anything that happens on your island. I'm just the person who developed it to the point where that island was possible in the first place.
Okay, but what's the restriction on my island?
Restrictions are whatever government restrictions are going to be, number one, right? Yeah, so yeah. Start with that. I don't determine what those things are, but I'm going to help you navigate them because of my experience or whatever experience I have with it. And we'll navigate that as a community, but we'll also navigate that individually. And then the other restrictions are that the only other restriction would be essentially that there's communal property. There's communal systems, there's communal transformation, there's communal, bathrooms that essentially the people who run that business, the people who run that communal space, decide what the rules are. Now, I actually decide much less than most people think. Most of the work or decisions are made by the people who are on the boots
Hell
on the ground.
Yeah, I don't have to be micromanaging, but in the I'm end, not. When all of a sudden I'm going to get kicked off the island, I'm the head some bitch in charge.
I'm not. All I do is just, I'm the backstop that takes responsibility that if for whatever reason we're going to go bankrupt, I'll take all the expenses. That's it. That's the only, all I'm really doing is acting as a
let me ask this question. They're 2-acre. I got one of my 30 homes there. Is it on land they hold deed title to?
Yes.
Or are they leasing it? What?
Nope. They own the title to the land.
Okay. We need to start off with that. All right. So yes. When I come into your community, how large are these lots?
Right now we're mapping it all out. Like we're literally, physically, getting surveyors and doing that whole thing. The theory is that, we're basing this off a model that is known as the market gardener. Okay. So the market gardener basically built on a 1.7 acre property, an entire 6-figure farming business operating with 4 people working, 2 like husband and wife, and then 2, support members help out. Non-tractor, no till farming, all that kind of stuff. They're growing $150,000, $170,000 a year worth of food, and they have their house and their homestead on that farm. That's the model we're going with and saying, look, a family or a farmer with his wife and some help from others can sustain a full life, a thriving life, not just 30,000 a year or 34 or whatever poverty line. I'm talking fully thriving, lifestyle off a 1.7 acre farm. So our goal is to divide it up to 1.5 to 2-ish acre lots, enable people to say, if you hate the community, you want to just do your own thing and farm your own land, great. You could do that right here on your little island. But if you want to play with the community or you want help, or maybe you got older, maybe when you bought into the community, you were young and nimble, but then all of a sudden you aged out or you had an accident, a motorcycle accident, now you're quadriplegic. Okay, great. Well, we can take care of that farm for you. And for whatever the community does, meaning the co-op does to take care of your farm, then depending on what they do. So if I had to prepare the soil, grow the food and sell the food, then obviously we take a bigger cut. But if I only have to sell the food, then we take a smaller cut. And I say we is the community. Now, how do we determine what that cut is? Well, we determine it based on the economics of a community.
I want to know how you determine what's a community. If you got private property you're talking my language because this is what happens.
Time.
Donna and I, everybody, join our hippie commune of the commune of collective sure. of will be, and you're definitely an ad. Well, of course they are. We're productive people with, quality family and, respectful sure. individuals and whip ass and bring some resources. And I got my own tools. So, I mean, we pick you. So I go, yeah, but why would I want to live with you? What do you add to my life? What am I going to get out of it?
So,
and
I'll add one more rule. One more rule. You're part of the community. Somehow you get voted off out of the community or voted out of the island, or you vote yourself out, meaning you're like, I'm out. I just want to sell. Great. We have a right of first refusal. When you're leaving, I or the community can buy your farm or buy your piece before you can sell it to somebody else. So anyone, but at what price? Well, at the price that somebody else is willing to pay you it. So if you went out and let's say you own your 2 acre lot and somebody comes up to you and says, hey, I'll give you $600,000 for your community or for your little farm, right? Fine. No problem. We have the right of first refusal to buy it at that price point or at whatever price point you'd be willing to sell it to us. If it's cheaper, great. So my goal is back to be the backstop. Just have enough resources that I can always buy the farm. I can always buy back the farm so that I again can pick my neighbor. And that's it. And then how do I pick our neighbor? So then you have systems for that. Well, you have to have systems for that. Meaning, number one, you cannot buy a lot on our farm without first becoming a member. To become a member, there's systems that go through. Number one, you have to come and get involved. Number two, you have to get along. You have to respect the community. And the easiest test of all of that is time. It's the only way that it can keep the bad apples out.
Well, has anybody, have you gone to this level yet? Has anybody bought, you know, lots, built homes?
No, people have invested to some degree. And what we're doing now is allowing people to, what we're going to start enabling is people can invest in the farm and then be first in line to have the lots. We're at the point now where the first house is going to be built, right? The first kind of communal space and house is going to be built. And now, because I'm going to divide the land and do all these things and say, okay, this is going to be one island. This is going to be another
your island. Political subdivision or your subdivision of real estate of stroke dash form or something.
Just like a normal real estate development. The only difference is this one has part of its kind of systems that has to function as a farm. It has to be a fully self-sustaining homestead if for whatever reason you wanted that to be it. But it's also, remember, here's the incentive of that though. Here's the incentive of why jump through those hoops. To buy the residential land that borders our farm, you'll pay minimum $10 a square foot, period. To buy what I paid for the land 9 years ago with my father is 17 cents a square foot. So let's be real here. The abundance is instant if you can go from agricultural land to now agricultural land with a house on it that is now skyrockets in value. Now every financial system is going to help you with that. I'll get real with you, right? The first house we're building is on a 5 acre property, 5 acre piece, because the farm is divided into multiple little lots essentially, because that's the way farm has been divided over time, right? So there's four major lots that are on the property, the smallest of which is the 5 acre piece. That's where we've done the most work. That's where we're building the first house, which, like I said, is going to be my house, but it's a community house too. Okay. It really is designed to have, it's an 8 bedroom home and I don't have kids and I don't have a family. So it's designed as a communal place. Okay. Long story short, the way that that's going to work is that people can come and establish themselves and establish what they're going to build. But the economics of this is super, super, super lucrative. Here's why. I pay 17 cents a square foot. I build a house on it. Let's say this 8 bedroom house costs $700,000, $750,000. Keep the math simple. $750,000 to build the house. Great. I pay that house cash, or if I get a loan, whatever it is, I pay the house cash or whatever. I get it done, right? The house is now built. Then I have somebody come and evaluate the value of that property, right? So now it was farmland with a functioning farm business in it, but that doesn't matter. The business itself is not taken into the account of the value of the property, right? The trees, the location, other things are there, but not the business. Now there's a house on it. How much is the comparable worth? Well, guess what? There's not that many comparables. How much demand is there for a homestead like ours compared to demand for the home that's down
the street? It's going to be going up as these kind of things develop.
Well, it's already happening. So look, I'll give you an example. A similar size home, square footage, down the street sold for $1.8 million. Great. So if I come in, build a house cash for $750,000, but then the next day it's worth $1.8 million, well, guess what? I can go to the bank, say, give me a loan for 65% or whatever it is. Give me a loan against the farm. Now I take the money, and now I have money to do the next thing. Well, guess what the next thing is? Ah, you're a full-time worker at our farm. Let's build your house. So now you can literally generate revenue and property value just by going from farm to residential farm.
I understand. It's good to have this kind of plan. My thing is that in the people in my lifetime, and the value is not getting some, you know, loan and a mortgage from a bank. There's individuals that just plop down cash. You know, this is the
loan. I'm one of those people.
Right.
That's what I'm trying to say.
See, this is the point. I it just dawned on me in the last year or so that my friends and I and a lot of people, we bust our ass and retire in 401k and play in the system as they rip us off of inflation and just sure. rip us off. And, you know, all this to what? To get, you know, just a small farm to sit on and chill out and retire. And when I go, I think if they just got out of your way, you can do that at 23 and start your family. You know, your family helped build it.
I built this plan
this life instead of waiting, just freaking do it. You know,
built this plan to become an investor essentially in community, in real estate, in talent, in people. And I decided at 9 years ago that I could retire at 35 if all I do is get that first house built at the farm. Guess what? I'm going to get that first house built at the farm. I've done all the legal work. I've done all the things. I have the money now to do it. And I did that by hustling and by growing a fuck ton of food and going through all the social pains and all the problems that come with building community. And trust me, it wasn't an easy road, but we're getting there. And it's still not going to be easy even once I build the house. But once I build that first one, the financial jump that you go from farmland only to farm residential land is so massive that I can literally fund the rest of the community.
I understand. See, this is the one thing where the communal living people freak. And they'll go, see, he's being a capitalist. He's sure. out there, you know, turning raw, you know, goods into more and making money and doing. And he's the very thing that we wanted to get away from, all you robber baron of landlord, whatever the hell. I mean, you know. This is you're being an example, the very thing they're trying to think that they can create what you're talking about just by wanting it.
Create it
don't mean nothing.
Create it. If you could do better, create it. Because that's how this community started. I thought I can do society better. Guess what? I figured out a couple of ways that are better to me and better for the people who are around me who agree. But I've seen way too many communities fail because they're trying to be too fucking communist in the way that they operate, where everything has to go through some council and everyone has to vote on everything. That's not how it works. I'm smarter at finance than the other person. But guess what? Other people are smarter. Other people way better farmers than I am. Okay.
You know, this is what's unique about your facility. And, you know, the one thing I was glad to hear is that when you may get first refusal and you want to be part of the commune and the collective and the co-op of whatever, you know, you abide by the rules and don't be a dick. And that really what it comes down to. Don't be a dick. I mean, you know, that's just, you know, you don't be a dick. So you have, but I got ownership. Do I file that ownership? Did I get my 2 acres, you know, 1.7 and our land, I think it was 1.85 or something. It's 2 acres. So I'm going, you go and you file that with the local community. It's kind of the, you know, the county recorder of its mind.
We're going to do it in 2 locations, just like everything else we're doing in the system and outside of the system. Here's how I'll do that. There's an app for that. That's not an app. Remember, the app isn't for freedom. The app is for harmonious freedom. It's about harmony. The harmony piece is where the agreements come in, right? Freedom is not me making a legal contract with you, because freedom would be, look, that there's no legal contract. That's the ultimate freedom. But we both know that from time to time, you need something to reference. So if you reference that thing, everyone agrees to the same terms. Now, think about it from this perspective. You're a member of a 150-person community. There are more people who want to be a part of the community than there are membership spots. So there's value in the membership spot that you own. I said the word own. Imagine owning your membership, not only owning the land, but even if you don't have enough money to buy the land, you can own your membership because you paid your dues. You did your work to get it, become a member. You paid the fee, let's say $1,000. Let's go with simple math here. So you join the community, you're now a member, you pay $1,000. Paying, but it's not paying, it's investing. Because here's the thing. One, when you give the $1,000, that's a equity raise event. The co-op took equity for your share. You now own the share, right? That share is recorded legally, the government, the Canada, whatever, in the books of a corporation or the co-op, which is a corporation of sorts, right? And done through an NFT, a blockchain system. That says, you're the owner of this share. You're the only person who can do it.
Security, here comes the man.
No, it's not the man. I don't control the blockchain, right? So
No, everyone, I mean, when you talk about the securities, when you're doing equity or you're doing blockchain or tokens on, you know, then they just want to be a pain in the ass.
Look, the point is, just hear me out, right? So $1,000 comes in. Now 150 people paid $1,000. Now you have $150,000 to develop the plan where everyone's going to get their island and all those things. So you now have money to get going, to get somewhere. So you don't fail. Now it's not guaranteed you don't fail, but at least you have more chance of success. Here's the beauty though. 150 people now fill up the community. There's 300 people who are applying to get a membership. Well, guess what? I want out of the community, or somebody else wants out of the community because for whatever reason they want out. Fine. They find somebody who's willing to buy their membership. Now, those person who's going to buy the membership has to qualify for membership, meaning they have to meet the minimum requirements for what membership look like. They have to have been around for a year. They have to get to know the people. They have to understand the values. They have to fill out a form that says that they understand whatever it is.
Replacements.
Great. But now there's 300 qualified applicants, right? Qualified people who can be a member. They're just waiting for the membership. Well, I don't have to sell my membership for $1,000. I could sell it for $10,000. Now, here's the beauty of that. I can, as the NFT founder, the co-op can say, hey, if you sell your membership, you're going to get 100% of the revenue minus our royalty because we made the original community. We made the original thing. So let's say that royalty is 25%. Let's just say simple math here. So you bought your membership for $1,000. You sold it 3 years later because you wanted to leave for $10,000 because now there's more demand than there is supply. That's how that works. Great. $2,500 goes back to the co-op. $7,500 goes to you. So you made an investment. Guess what? Today, you're willing to make that investment. Because why? Because you either believe in the community or you don't believe in the community. In the same way that you either believe in Bitcoin or you don't believe in Bitcoin. If you don't believe in Bitcoin, no problem. Go find the next one or don't invest. But if you do believe in it, here's a way that you can invest. Here's a way you can cash out at any one moment for whatever the market determines, not what I determine. I'm not the landlord who just determines what the price of the value of membership is. You are, and the person coming in.
Now, what kind of contract is that you would have?
Smart contract done on the blockchain, an NFT.
No, it doesn't matter how you do it. It's that they, you know, would allow for a contract, a homeowner association or deed restrictions or what do you call it, to where you make your property conditional that you have to have, you can't sell it unless there are some conditions met by the determining board, the factor of what.
It's almost in the same way that you would do a condominium building.
Right. That's it. What do you call that?
I don't know the exact name of it, but basically you'd operate under the same laws or the same systems or the same governing systems of a condo. Meaning when somebody buys a condo, they have to pay condo fees.
Right. So this is a structure my point is that this is already in existence. They do this.
Yeah, it exists. So, I'm just going to follow the exact same system of condo.
It can't be done. It's already been done.
No, it exists literally everywhere. There's all kinds of condo associations where when you come in, there's certain stipulations that you have to follow. You have to pay your condo fees, member, NNF. You don't pay your condo fees, you eventually lose right to your property. And then it has to be sold or could be sold or taken from you at the price.
And then there's a lien against that
for the price they get paid. So you're just operating on the exact same ecosystem that the current systems of checks and balances we currently use, which currently work, by the way, to some degree, or generally work, they work. So let's just use that system.
So your experience in dealing with the crown, they're supportive of this, or you're finding a lot of little bitty roadblocks?
They're becoming more and more supportive of it. Here's why. There's five economic reasons why the farm is a powerful way of doing it. Number one, real estate, which I just explained to you. You can go from farm to farm residence, and farm residence, that gap is a huge incentive for people to get into farming and get it going, okay? First thing. Plus, by the way, you can be a farmer and also still make money doing other things, but just not claim that personally. That's what I do. I'm a full-time farmer. All my revenue as Marcangelo is made farming. But I also have a corporation that I'm the sole owner of. And all my other revenue doing consulting is made by that corporation. That corporation is not me. So I'm playing by the rules, but I'm also going into the gray zones of those rules. I make a ton of money doing other things, but I also make money farming. But guess what? I'm still a qualified farmer. I still can build my house because I still follow to the letter of the law. I follow your rules so I can make my house. Great. Fine.
Sometimes they go, you're not following the spirit of, we wanted to rule you of the law. I mean,
the spirit of the law. Do I follow the law? Yes or no? That's all the law.
Man, don't even start with me, man. Yeah. I know how the man is. But the, I'm looking forward to this. And the reason I bring this up, longevity of the concept, is that when it starts working And it's the way that you're talking about, the where you have private, you know, ownership, and there's conditional of the co-op, of the intention, of the vision, of what's coded into the app, the blockchain, of the conditional, of whatever the hell we figure this out.
Sure.
You know, those are going to be support. See, they're doing it right, and they're being, you know, self-sustaining, and they're not polluting the earth, and they're doing it, and they're being free. Damn it, they're not allowed. You know, the hellfire missile to them, and
I'm not worried
about that. I'm just, long term, you're wondering, you know, is this really what, you know, they say this is what they want. What do they really want? Well, as long as you're all vaccinated, then we'll be okay, you know. So you still have these things, but this where it comes into the next stage. A lot of the people that understand that your success may be what brings attention. And then it's like mutual defense. They keep saying that we need a mutual defense. And all I can think of, I'm in the 30 home area, and like my little dogs, when I was a kid, I had this one little dachshund dog and a German shepherd. And a little dog go pick fights and then run back, and here comes all the other dogs, and ha ha ha, I'm behind the fence of my dog, my friend will kick your butt. Well, you know, there's going to be people like that, or kids like that, or they go get in trouble, they come back to the community. What's expectation do people expect and help defend, and the legal of wait a minute and none shall pass, and show me your warrant and we'll take it? I mean, you know, is there some mutual defense obligation? Then if you have communities, you know, with the network of other people, I spend my summers and my winters in, I mean, is that a consideration on the drawing board? Do you even want to go down that path? Has it been discussed? You know, this defense of individual members and other communities, do you get involved in that?
Not necessarily. We get involved in defending the farm from the perspective of the farm itself, but I am not there. Your personal safety is not our communal responsibility.
Thank you.
Period. Like, if you go pick a fight and you get beat up, that's on you.
There it is. Your personal safety is not a communal responsibility.
Yeah.
Which also means, you know, conversely, is that the community is that? Do I have some obligation to the community? How much do I gotta, you know, get your musket and man the wall? I mean, you know, how much obligation do I have?
You won't have the obligation, but you'll have the heart of wanting to do it. That's the point. There's not an obligation. You're just gonna want to do it. Nobody's obliged to be a part of the army. They just sign up for it. Now, some do it because of financial reasons, and some do it because of honor, and they want to fight terrorists or whatever version of that. Now, do I agree with that? That's not my decision. I'm not the decider of what you do with your time and money. If you want to do it the way you want to do it, you do it the way you want to do it. Now, as long as you're abiding by the rules of, let's say, if I lived in a condo and I abide by the rules of the condo, I can do whatever the fuck I want with it. Now, does that mean that people always get along? No. There's always somebody, the one neighbor that plays the music too loud or has people over. Nah, 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 nah. Well, guess what? I'm going to let society and social dynamics figure that out. I'm not here to make all the rules.
Yeah, one of the things, the reason it was called is like 80 homes in square mile, a little bit more area in Northwest Phoenix. It was called Sunburst Farms.
Sure.
And the only thing that bound it was that they had a common irrigation well system, because there's like an ocean of water under Phoenix, with no regardless of what they tell you. And we had like 40 years of water, you know, that we're fine. But it was every 2 weeks, I get 6 inches deep of freaking irrigation of, I got pastures and, you know, 60, 80 foot pine trees. I mean, you know, it's just add water, it grows. So the only thing that bound that community together was the irrigation system. You know, that was it. It was out in the middle of the desert. It's been there for a long time. So then when something would happen, they want to have some kind of a community who can and can't anything. And it was based on, you know, somebody, you know, they got too many boats in the front yard. I mean, you know, whatever the hell it is. It was a nice area they wanted to have. But then here come the city. You know, the lawn Nazis again reporting. But the reason that I like the 2 acres is because it was enough room that you could do pretty much whatever you wanted to sustain yourself. Yeah. You have some big fields and kids play soccer. You got the whatever the hell. I mean, you got some space.
Yep.
You have a swimming pool if you want. I mean, you got a couple acres. You got enough to park your RVs and that
you can
your kids. And
you can more than sustain your life very comfortably on two acres.
Yeah, 2 acres, you're good. The thing is that it's also, you're just far enough from your neighbor that when they close their windows and you got Jordan Page rocking out to 1 a.m, they're not, you know, they're able to sleep. I mean, you know, it's just, but you want to not be a
But that's
jerk.
Part of good communal design physically too, like where physically. The communal center is.
Exactly.
Is far the furthest place from all the individual homes. So the loudest amount of noise and the most amount of traffic is going to happen away from the main homes. That's the way we designed it. And so you just have to have good communal foresight. But everything, like anything in business and in life, is about having foresight. Well, guess what? 9 years ago when I started, I had some foresight that I should plant more trees. Okay. I knew that carbon taxes were going to become a thing. I knew that every tree I planted, I would make the money back in carbon taxes, let alone how much fruit it grows. Okay. There's so many reasons why this farm is going to be economically
growing. You get paid by the government for planting a tree?
Of course you will. Of course you will. Think about it. Come on. Think about it. Carbon tax is going to be a thing, whether you fucking like it or not, right? Yes or no? Yes or no, is carbon tax going to be a thing?
It's definitely a thing. I don't know if it's a thing, but it's definitely a thing.
I'm not saying you want it to be a thing. I'm not saying you agree with it. Is it going to happen?
It's definitely going that way. I was surprised that it's gone as far as it has. It hasn't gone as fast and as far as they want, but they're never going to give up this carbon tax thing.
And in Canada, we're already paying it. In America, not so much, but in Canada, we're already paying it.
Yeah, they want it. Here it comes.
It's coming. It's coming. Whether you like it or not, it's coming. Okay, great. So you can either fight the forces of nature, aka humanity, or you can align yourself with it.
Well, I don't do it, you know, good, bad. I can see it's productive. It's a good idea because that's the first thing we're going to do. I mean, you go on the land, what's the first thing? You got to have water, dig the well, or you got to have electricity, get the panels up, or you got to have, you know, plant the trees because, man, the sooner you do that, the better. And my thing is, I go, the first thing I'm doing is building, because we manufacture domes, I'm building me a big, at least 32 foot of a freaking, I need to put stuff under shade and work and flat concrete if I can, you know, all the crap doesn't get UV to hell. I mean, you know, I need to, you know, have a base to start operating from. And one of the early things is you need a water system, of course, you know, to do whatever.
Water, power, shade.
To water the trees. I mean, you know, I need to get trees in. And
water,
Arizona,
power, shade, food, and toilets.
Yep. So I'm with you, brother. You know, the tree thing, you can't do them early enough because, hell, it takes 3 years for it to even do its first anything, depending on how large you plant them and then what kind you get and all this other stuff. So, and then we started, of course, we've talked a lot of guys, they do the hoogle mounds and how you prep the soil. And you do,
yep.
And in Arizona, you add water, it grows. Only so long. I mean, it's been millennia of, you know, nutrients, you know, doing, you know, the sun bleached, you know, soil, but it's very productive. So then I'm going, might be good to ask you here. I was thinking like 6 inches of wood chips, man. I mean, sawdust, whatever. I mean, just get material on there and just leave it for a few years and just let the mycelium take care of whatever. And then I got some soil.
That's exactly what we're doing, but we get it for free.
So wood chips is a thing, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Here's why. There's tons of trees being cut down all over for different reasons, power lines, cleanup, trees die. We have ash trees here that all got attacked by the ash beetle, essentially. So they all die. They have to get wood cut down and turn into wood chips. We have so much wood chips because everyone in our area is taking care of their trees in the same way. We have so much wood chips coming in. We get literally trucks full of wood chips every day, if not every second day at the farm.
Oh, my God.
So we're taking our GMO corn and soil field and covering it in wood chips, building the soil slowly but surely, always ahead of time. We're in advance. I'm years ahead of where we are today because I'm operating with that mentality. That's why we're succeeding. Now, I'm not saying we're successful. We're my version of successful. Maybe we're not successful to you. I don't care. I'm looking for 150 people who agree. Out of 7.5 billion, 8 million, there's going to be 150 people who agree, and there's always going to be more demand than there is supply, 100%. Why?
Mark, it's all about me. I'm with you, bro.
It's not about me.
Oh,
it's
hell yeah. The only way that I know how to be free and productive and live a comfortable life is to advocate it for everybody else. That's the only way it's going to happen.
I agree.
I want what I want. Now, yes. People that want what I want, and we can be able to build the structure to get what I want, and we all got what we want, and we're happy. You know,
sure.
I'm good. But I tell you, I'm not doing it for you. I guarantee that. You know, I could do it for you so we all benefit from it, and there's a cooperation. But, man, hell no, I'm not doing it so I can be unhappy.
I just focus on, look, what I learned about permaculture is that permaculture is about the balance of the ecosystem. So what I do is I take what I need for me, but I also create more than I need, meaning I'm always building the ecosystem over time. I'm always taking more than I'm receiving, meaning I'm always importing wealth. Wealth meaning dollars and cents, time, energy, wood chips turn into wealth of the soil later. So there's always more coming in than is ever going out. And
how
as long as that balance is maintained. What?
How are you spreading it? How thick? What's your formula?
As thick as we can, honestly. But the you know, right now across a huge portion of the field, maybe we just did about 6 or 7 acres worth at 6 inches of wood chips.
Oh my God, that was my dream. I'm going at the desert.
Now the soil maintains moisture. So then all of a sudden you don't have to use as much water. If you don't have to use as much water, you don't need as much common infrastructure. The less common infrastructure you need, the less then blah, 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 the less bickering between neighbors.
This is one question that I asked Jay Noon up here. He does a lot of this kind of stuff. And I helped him clear an acre last summer. You know, I got all heavy equipment up then. But there's rocks. I mean, you guys got to deal with freaking rocks, man. I mean, oh my God. But I asked, does it have to be a certain size? I mean, big wood chips, little wood chips, sawdust. I mean, does sawdust work better?
All of it. The bigger the size, the longer it takes to decompose.
Yeah.
So it depends on what you're going to plan on growing there and what you're going to use. If you want to grow sooner, then you should make it smaller. Sawdust is better.
Yeah, so it's not disadvantageous to have sawdust. I mean, say
no,
to it,
not at all. It depends what you want to grow. And it depends what's like, for example, when you put a bunch of wood chips, you're adding a lot of acidity to the soil in certain scenarios. So, okay, that's good for some plants like blueberries, but bad for other plants. So it's back to think about where you're going with it. Look, put it this way. Community is best done just like construction. Measure twice, cut once. Mm-hmm. That's it. You need a fucking plan. Now, who has the vision of planning? Well, guess what? I believe that answer is entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs are self-accountable because at the end of the day, I either fucking made it or I didn't fucking make it. And that's why I deeply respect the art of entrepreneurship, but I deeply respect it from the perspective that you get to do what you want to do as an entrepreneur and I get to do what I want to do as an entrepreneur. And we live or die by the sword in that way. I either made it or I didn't make it. Now, sometimes there are governmental forces and other things that are sad, obviously.
Yeah.
Oh, I was a great entrepreneur. My restaurant was running really great, but now all of a sudden I got shut down by the government. Well, guess what? You know what doesn't get shut down by the government? A farm.
Essential food.
It's essential that you operate a farm. The farm is a pocket of freedom. Yes, within a system, but you live in the system. You're not escaping the system.
But when you go and they say, you know, seeds aren't essential and we decided what was essential and not essential, and I'm thinking that welding. Immediately, a friend of mine, we were doing a show and he goes, well, essential, I think that welding rod fixed my
you're
boiler
just not innovating.
Is essential, I don't
know. You can go find the seeds for free. If you really want the seeds, you'll find them, okay? The point is, you always fucking find a way, okay? And many people just ignored the fucking rules. You just if you don't agree with it, don't agree with it, and then take the fucking the hit if you have to take the hit. Go to court if you have to go to court.
But okay, now this is you know, we've got. I wanted to touch on the Hoogle Mound thing because you have a lot of wood up there. Are you building intentional tree orchard long?
Yeah, absolutely. We've planted hundreds and hundreds of trees. I mean, this year alone, we planted 101 cherry trees a few weeks ago. I mean, we're constantly planting. It's turning into a forest. Like our GMO cornfield has now become a forest of sorts. It's just like in permaculture and soil restoration, it starts with weeds, then it goes to grasslands, then from grasslands it goes to forest. We're in certain parts of the farm still in weeds and grassland, but in other parts of the farm we're getting to the forest stage. And all of that is things that you learn while doing
what does that if you're not tilling, is it just mowing it or mowing at certain times or keeping
it's a function of sunlight and shade and moisture, right? as the forest grows, it creates shade. As shade happens, then other plants don't grow underneath it, and so on and so forth. So all the different things that start to play out is that you're essentially functioning by watching nature. If this is what happens in nature, then you just need to recreate the similar conditions that
will
eventually.
So tell me about the winter. You know, how are you guys? Are you just hunkering in until it's spring? Or,
some of us are. I travel on the farm from April 1st to October 31st. I'm in Montreal. I'm not always on the farm every day. I'm not on the farm right now, for example. But the point is that I'm generally taking care of the farm those months. And then on the winter months, I travel. Now I visit eco villages. I'm building another eco village, or I'm investing in other eco villages in Costa Rica or in Mexico or whatever it is. And so I'm taking what I know here and I'm bringing it there. And then,
Okay. There's a good point. Yeah. You got Montreal, Canada, you know, and what'd you say? Costa Rica,
Mexico.
You know, so freaking not the same. Okay.
Totally.
But is the same.
The way social structures work are the same. Permaculture is the same. The principles of permaculture are the same. The ecosystem is different. What grows in Mexico doesn't necessarily grow in Canada. What grows in Canada doesn't necessarily grow in Mexico. But the principles of the first principle of permaculture is to listen. The hardest thing that humans can do. Hardest thing is to listen, because we get an idea and we want to do it the way we want to do it. But if you listen a little bit better, and I'm talking about listening to
what?
Nature.
You mean to the, nature. The land, to the locals?
Yes.
To
Where does the water naturally accumulate? What is naturally occurring on this property? What is not naturally occurring on this property? Mm-hmm. How can I work with the forces of nature versus against the forces of nature? How can I use some of nature and bring in some input from man?
You know, all this changes when, you know, communication. Starlink is a thing. And I just want to know how far up Uncle Sam's butt Elon Musk is. You know,
I don't think he's that far above Uncle Sam's butt. I honestly think he's done a phenomenal job of using his entrepreneurial mindset and first principles thinking to innovate in a way that nobody else has been able to innovate the way he has. Not zero people on the planet have innovated the way he has innovated.
You know, Corbett gives me every week, he's on my ass, you know, and I just had Luke Radowski on yesterday. We were yakking it, and they're all on my ass for, you know, you Elon Musk fanboy. I can't believe that you know, and I'm going.
You can hate all day, but he's innovating. I don't care whether you hate on him or not. You can love or hate him. I think the way Starlink is going to change the face of the planet.
Totally.
Period. And if we don't do it, the Chinese are doing it anyway.
Or Bezos.
Somebody's going to do it, right? Elon is the only one. Elon's the face of it. He's not the only person doing it. He's not the only company doing it. And by the way, he's not an individual doing it. It's a group of people. It's a whole fucking company and organization that found a way through the forces of the market to survive. Now, part of that is government contracts. But guess what? It's because the government can't do it themselves. So they hire this other person, just like
you know, I'm thinking what the deal is. A lot of the stuff that's going on now, they're pulling the trigger, you know, all the mandates and you got to and you can't and stuff because they're running out of time. I think, you know, the people are starting to realize since certainly, I mean, it's been an evolution, and the Lovolution during the Ron Paul years in 08, that kind of triggered him. Whoa, what the hell just happened?
Well, what we started to learn is about where money came from and fractional reserve banking and all the challenges that come with that. I interviewed Ron Paul. I drove to Ithaca, New York, and I went directly interviewed Ron Paul to have a conversation about, you know, a lot of the forces that started the farm was I went to Occupy Wall Street and I learned about where money came from. And I had learned before, but I started learning more. I met Luke Rakowski there. So over time, your ecosystem and your network and all these things, you start to learn, but it takes time. And so many people just want it now. I want it now. And because we're used to it, we're used to clicking a button and Amazon shows up within 24 hours for 48 hours. So yes, you're not going to have a sustainable community. You're not going to have a sustainable life because it's unsustainable to expect everything tomorrow.
I want to be able to start now. I want to be able to do what I want now. I want to begin the process now. And the thing is that the result is not going to be now. I mean, you know, that you got to invest. Plants grow when they freaking grow. I mean, you know, soil develops as it develops. You know, trees get big in
time, land
the way it is. So, you know, you got to plan this stuff. And the biggest thing is children. And one of the things in the level is like, things that once they learn how bad it is, man, do I want to bring kids into this? I go, Hell yeah. You breed them out. I mean, that's how you do it. It's generation next. That's how this happens, you know, mm-hmm. and what you're doing and you created. And is a family in your future? Do you even want to have children? Is this building up?
Yeah, I'm I think so. I think it's most likely in my future. We'll figure it out as time goes. I'm going with the flow on all those things. But I mean, we will have families. Some of our members have kids or have had, kids. Some of them are more mature than others. Some are younger than others. It's a family eco village nonetheless. We're going to have families there, whether I have a family or not.
Right. You know, we need it. You know, it's one thing, Richard and Lisa Grove, you know, Tragedy and Hope, they're good friends and they were up here all week. We had a good time. And they were kind of holding off for a while. And it was Donna and I convinced them to have children. I'm going, no, I'm telling you, that's what it's all. It's going to change your total outlook and longer term thinking. And Lucas, and it's just awesome to watch your family grow. And now with a lot of the other people that are graduates of, and this could be, you know, part of, I think, you have classes. You know, you do, the people go up there, just experience it. Do they do a,
people come every single Friday and Saturday. People ask questions. People show up. This farm is so unique. People show up every day asking questions, looking for answers. You're asking, we've been talking for 2 hours almost now. People ask me questions, question after question after question. Why? Why am I the source of some form of knowledge that other people don't have? Well, it's just because I've done more than most people have. In this category, ask me how a microwave works and I'm a fucking idiot. Ask me how a computer works and I don't know. The point is, I figured some shit out in the things that I figured things out in, and therefore I have answers in those things. And there's always people willing to ask questions about these things. So I can capitalize that in some way, shape, or form.
You know, what you
capitalize, importantly, right? I can use my skills and whatever I know, and you can use your skills, and so can the other members in the community to capitalize on what they want to create. Period.
Well, you're confirming my bias. You know, here's somebody coming from, the part of the empire of, you know, the crown of whatever the hell in communist socialist Canada doing it. So, I mean, you know, what's my excuse, you know? So it's, I'm looking for kind of really the truth and the answer, you know, uncovering the secrets, exposing the lies. That's my spiel. And the thing that, you know, I'm getting from you is what because I was wondering, because when Chloe was on that panel that we were on at the Greater Reset, you know, hers is totally different. It's a communal voting kind of we get and hippie, whatever the hell.
Hers is very idealistic.
Yeah, I'll help. But anything that works, something like what you're doing that works, they reject anything that's not communal of what I'm going. It's not going to work.
But they're not living it. They're not living the thing that you say you want to live. And I'm much closer to I am living it in many ways. By the way, right before this podcast, I brought in 21 dozen eggs to the restaurant right across the street. I'm living
it. Yeah, no, we couldn't keep enough eggs. I mean, we had, you know, like, I don't know, a few dozen a day, and we just couldn't.
The world works on supply and demand. I don't care what dollar, whether you're using Bitcoin or using American dollars, or you're using fucking shitcoin. I don't care. Everything works on supply and demand. If you want it and I have it, it works. Period. That's human nature. We always,
especially if you get all the crap out of the way and do it.
And you figure it out. You figure it out. And some basic training in entrepreneurship is super important. We need to learn finance.
You really confirmed my bias anyway, that I knew it was going to be something like this. And I finally, get some of these documents. You talk to enough people, it starts to, the ones that have been around 13, 10, 6, 5, 20, 30 years are the ones that sooner or later, it comes down to someone that did it, had the vision, wanted freedom for everybody so they could have it for themselves, and the other people agreed and it was successful. If it is the organization, see, that's what we call it, Steiger's Law from Arizona. It's a long story, but it goes like this. Whenever you create an organization around a movement or a cause, sooner or later, every freaking time, the organization becomes more important than the reason you created it.
Of course.
Every time. So I'm going, quit. If the organization is structured in such a way to maximize freedom for the individual, fine. It's called the Declaration of Independence. That's why my show is called Declare Your Independence.
And it's still organized.
If you're going to have a government, the only purpose for it is defense of individual rights. So when it doesn't do that, it's time to alter, abolish it. Your right, your duty. Boom. Right. Sign me up. Okay, I get it. You know, that was the, we've had this discussion, you know, for, I don't know, since humans have been breathing in and out.
Since we started speaking, we've had the discussion. And before that, we were having it with grunts and ahs. We've always had the discussion. It is human nature. And I would say nature. I would just even remove the word nature, that there is agreements and governance that is governed by the laws of nature, by the simple fact of Darwinistic forces, that is that you either made it or you didn't. And that's the most democratic of all things. The most democratic of all things is also time. That is super democratic. And one of the things,
I got something to share with you.
Here's what I'll say to this. Okay. One of the main things that I would say is I want to find a way to constantly be importing people's value that they attribute to our brand. Why? Because brand is in limit. I can scale brand to infinity. Okay. The value of brand is not limited by anything physical other than reputation. So reputation, I can scale to the nines, right? What's my garlic worth? Well, it's what you're willing to pay for it. That's it. So if you think my garlic's better and there's a ton of demand and a limited supply, you'll pay more for it, period. So brand operates that way too. Great. So now you have these NFTs that have people membership rights and all the things that you could sell. It's an investment, not an expense. And therefore, and I think that that has, it's brilliant in many ways. And it's not because I invented it. I didn't invent blockchain. I didn't invent NFTs. I'm just going to take advantage of those things and understand the forces behind them and how they're democratic in many ways. And if we build our own coin and I say, hey, are you willing to invest in our coin? Why? Well, because you believe it's going to do better and you believe in our vision. Now, you might do that as a supporter. You might do that out of your own greed. You might do that for this reason, that reason, the other reason. I don't care what reason it is. If you believe in our coin, if in the same way that you believe in Bitcoin, or by the way, in the same way you believe in the American dollar, at the end of the day, it is in God we trust. Some social systems do exist. The biggest religion on the planet is money. And so at the end of the day, if we can provide value and say, hey, I think you can invest in this coin. And whether you're in New York or you're in Zimbabwe or you're in Hong Kong, you can invest in this coin wherever you are, as long as you have access to the internet, access to certain things, which is becoming more and more democratic. Then what we can do is create value purely out of time. Here's what I mean by that. Anyone who comes to the farm, the second they come onto the farm physically, they'll probably come with some form of device. Okay. If they don't have a device, we can clock them in via device. And the second they leave the farm via their device, it knows when they left that farm. Why? Because we have technology that does that, GPS, right? Great. The second you show up on the farm, you become a miner of our coin, regardless of what you're doing. No matter whether you're super valuable or you're completely invaluable to the community, is irrelevant. The only way that our coin is mined is sustainably through time. It's the most democratic of things. No matter how much how rich I am or how poor you are, doesn't matter. If I'm on boots on the ground, I'm mining this coin. Guess what? There's only a certain amount of coins and a much more demand. So now it gives you the incentive to come to the farm. Why? Because if I show up at the farm and I do my work at the farm, or if I'm just sitting on my computer or scrolling Instagram, if I'm at the farm and mining this coin, and guess what? There's somebody in New York that says, man, I heard about this community of Valhalla. That brand is really interesting. Let me buy their coin. Well, where do I buy the coin? I have to only buy it from the people who are mining it. Who's mining it?
People are there.
Guess what? Now we created more people are there. Now the more people are there, the more garlic we sell. The more garlic we sell, the more courses we sell, the more. So I'm building all I'm looking for at the end of the day. The most democratic thing that I've been able to find is the free market of supply and demand. I'm not talking about free market of dollars or Australian dollars or big. Blah, blah, blah. I'm talking about
voting.
Supply and demand. That's what I'm talking about.
Wallet voting. You vote with your feet. You vote with your effort. You vote with your time. You vote where you're at. You vote.
Yes.
Yeah. I got walletvoting.com. Got it in 03 because I knew this is where
amazing.
Going.
Great.
Anyway, this epiphany that I had. It was a couple of things. You know, there's a lot of things been happening. You know, I've been doing this for 30 years, you know, since the late 80s. I was in the day.
Sure.
And you get new revelations and you kind of get a bias and it gets confirmed. You know, everything a lot you're saying is confirming a lot of my biases. And I was doing a radio show on another show yesterday, and one of the audience members who were there before the show were kind of yakking it, you know, waiting to start. And you know, I've always been, I remember it was I've had a lot of guys on. You know, Anthony Gregory from Independent Institute years ago, we were friends and we were sitting around. And I finally, I asked him, I go, look, man, Austrian economics, where's the bumper sticker for that? I mean, everybody's going Austrian economics. Ron Paul gets on, you know, Leno, oh, Austrian economics. I do Austrian economics. I go, okay, what is Austrian? You know, libertarianism is, you know, the non-aggression principle or leave me aloneism and, you know, proper rule of government or something like that. Austrian economics. Well, as you read it or you go through, there really was never a bumper sticker for me to explain it. It was always like, you know, if you do this, it's like a chemistry experiment. You add this, this happens.
Yeah.
You know, it was always like a chart. There's always some, you know, example. There's always some, you know, law that how unintended consequences or what. I mean, I need something more basic and fundamental to be able to understand this. What you're talking about is kind of what this one young man said. He goes, let's see, bumper sticker. Action follows value. If you value something, you get that action. People put effort into it. You know, action follows value. So I'm going, Austrian economics, action follows value. It's a human action thing. Okay, I get it. So what you're talking about and the value of your coin and everything, action follows perceived value as an individual, which could be God knows what, you know?
Which also creates communal value, because now all of a sudden you mine the thing and now everyone can speculate on it. Whatever reason they're speculating on it is not up to me to determine. They get to determine what the value is, and the free market does that the most democratic way possible with the least amount of control possible. And at the end of the day, one of the quotes that I would add to what you said.
Rewards and punishment.
Hold on. I'll add one more thing to it, right? Yeah. Gandhi said, action expresses priorities. Simple. Our entire community at the end of the day operates on.
All right. See, that was a good way of saying action. It too. Action
expresses priorities.
I'm sorry, what?
Expresses priorities.
Expresses.
At the end of the day, people show up every fucking day at the farm and say, I want to do this. I want to do that. And I say, cool. Here are the ways you could do it here. Here's some of the ground rules. You'll get to know them over time. You'll have more and more sovereignty, and you'll feel more and more comfortable, and you'll feel more and more freedom to do those things. I literally do not have stated rules. The stated rules are purely social, purely. They do not exist anywhere other than in our own minds and our own hearts and the people who are showing up every day taking action. They're the people who are creating the rules. That's it.
Action expresses priorities. Which, you know, creates value and scarcity and all this other stuff. So
if you take enough consistent action, then you build brand or you build reputation. Once you build brand reputation, you can monetize that and then you can self-sustain off that. And that's a form of freedom.
You know, one thing before we finish up or hit the 2 hours, thanks for spending this extra time with us. This is awesome.
Yeah, no worries.
This is a very productive conversation. Probably, you know, more than I think either of us probably realize right now, because this is the discussion that everywhere I go, the Love Bus, we're going across the country. It's festival, event, a festival, activism, constantly for a year, and community keeps coming up every time.
Yep.
And I go, okay, you know, I got three questions. What do I have to do? What can I do? What's your conflict resolution? You answer those three questions, and they go, well, you have to. I don't want to do that. Well, you can't. I wanted to do that. You know, how are we going to describe? I mean, you know, so right off the bat, I need some fundamental basic things. And the first thing is, if I don't have mine, I'm not interested. Well, your system's come up. Yeah, you privately own this, but then cooperative or whatever. Some of these others are, I'm Lord God King Bufu of, you know, whatever I survey here. And okay, well, as long as I know that and I get a timeshare or something like that. Yep. But you're talking about actual, you own your property and then, you know, how you deal with the community and if you even do. And so I'm, you know, you're getting close, man. I mean, somebody's answering the questions. You know, I'm good. So the one thing that I wanted to share.
I have our version of answers, and that's the point.
Yeah, you have your version. You know, like that version goes to some other version. And if it can interface with, you know, another place and you could even move seasonally.
It has and it is. I trade, you know, hey, come to stay in Montreal. I'll go stay in Costa Rica. It's working. It's naturally working because people value wanting to come to Montreal, just like I value wanting to go to Costa Rica. That's why they change.
Now, here's one more thing that I wanted to add to the mix that we thought I'd like to get your comment on before we finish.
Yeah.
We have a site called piratewithoutborders.com.
Yeah.
And the point that we were doing there was the decentralization of technology down to the individual to empower this kind of stuff.
Sure.
So we're redoing the page next week. And so we've had it up for a couple of years working on it. And what we've done is the top tech news on Freedom's Phoenix. There's a lot of stuff, power generation, shelter, energy, communication. I mean, all the food, water, transportation, automation, education, health, you know, remedies. I mean, all this is just information that empowers the individual to be not off the grid, but above the grid. We're not off the grid. We're above the grid. We got our own pirate ship and so on. If you go to piratewithoutborders.com, at the upper left, it says take visual tour and you'll see the ship, the Precariat. Okay. We have 3D animation of and whatever. But the real thing is, are the letters of Captain Mark, the letters of Mark and his first mate Reprisal, letters of Mark and Reprisal. Mm-hmm. Now, Reprisal is the female character. Then we have a doctor and the kid and all this other stuff. So all these letters, you know, depict all these different aspects. Now, the most recent one is the one that I think applies to what we're doing. And we have, a lot of stuff, on currency, on private community, hailing frequencies, invisible to crown, all that stuff. Sure. Scuttlebutt is... around the water cooler, it's gossip. It's what your reputation precedes you. And what we're talking about is these communities. What I hear is that, we had that. Well, why aren't you there now? Well, there was this one guy. There's always that one guy. There's always that one sociopath, psychopath of crazy woman, Karen of, lawn Nazi or something. Right. So I'm going, how do you structure that out? How do you know who these people are? How do you get rid of them? How do you identify them is first thing. So Scuttlebutt is software that would be everybody has a Yelp or eBay ranking of,
a social credit system.
And biometric. I mean, it's got, the man, freaking social credit system. That's China crap. Where I go, you want to come on my ship and I'm going to space? Guess what? I know what the hell and who you are and reputation, resume of my friends and people's opinion. I respect it. I don't give a crap what the crown says. That's a whole nother thing.
There's a lot of things that keep the community together. One is a common enemy. Another is a common flag. They both work equally powerfully. Okay. Mm-hmm. The common flag is the common values that people keep together. The common enemy also keeps people together. Okay. Both of them work together. You can't avoid the common enemy, even if you want to, no matter how agreeable you are, because if you're fully agreeable, then you're nothing. You're not a community. You're just people. If you're not fully agreeable, then you have some rules and those rules naturally play out. And there's no one way to kick somebody off the island or off the ship, but there's also, there also becomes a time where that becomes natural and the societal pressure of people just disagreeing with that one guy will make that person leave, quote unquote, right? It will naturally happen. It will naturally occur. Now, it's not to say that there's no action to be taken, but you just need to figure out what those actions are and how you take them. Now, we focus on nonviolent communication. What that means is it doesn't put the judge is no one person. So I'm not the judge of all things. How we go about it is if one person has a problem with the other person, they end up both mutually agreeing who the judge is going to be. Once they agree who that judge is going to be, then conflict resolution stuff starts to happen. Both parties get to, say what they have to say, put up what they have to say. The judge's role is just to make sure that the communication is as constructive and nonviolent as possible. Doesn't mean that somebody doesn't yell. It might happen. If they do, we try and slow it down just like a judge would. And at some point, that person or the judge, and that judge could be a group of people, a small group of people too, if that's what they both agree on, right? The two parties that are in problems. And those two parties can also be, by the way, groups. Okay, they don't have to just be individuals. It could be a family and another family. Long story short, once that person or that group that is the judge that they both appointed agrees that this is the decision, everyone has to respect it. And that's it. And if you don't respect it, the person who doesn't respect it or the group that doesn't respect it does have to leave the island. That's as simple. But I'm not the judge.
Yeah. No, this is one thing that was interesting as we did. We got a lot of pushback in the beginning. You know, pirates, other bad guys and so on. And as you do the history, not so much. But it was
pirates had a way that you walk the plank. OK. And there was something beautiful about that, because if you feared the plank, a.k.a. you had the common enemy of the sea, that's the answer. Then you kind of started to play ball. And even if you didn't agree, eventually you'd switch captains or eventually switch ships. But at least in that journey, you're going to play ball because either that or you're going to face the sea. So if you want the sea, great, take the sea. If you think it's better out there, jump off the ship and start swimming.
We'll strand.
If you think it's better elsewhere, go there and just leave. That's fine.
Well, that was kind of how it worked, you know, because the captains, how do you captain or rule a bunch of pirates with guns and swords? How does that happen? It hasn't happened by consent.
It's back to a tragedy of the commons. What's good for me is to play ball with the other people. Once we're on a ship and we're sailing between Europe and the Caribbean, for example, at some point you're going to start working together, because if you don't, you're for sure the ship's going down. Okay.
So you start working together. But very interesting, because a lot of these were freed slaves, you know, escaped slaves, and sure. The piracy was, I don't know, you have letters of mark from all the crowns. They were all in agreement. We don't like the pirates, you know, stealing our gold that we stole from the Incas. I mean, you know, it's just, and
that's back to a game of power and common enemy. It's the same game we've always played. It's just a game. So you can fear it and you can demonize it, but that game always exists. Like you said, we don't want you stealing our gold. Well, our gold, what do you mean? You stole it from somebody else. Every piece of land did not, you know, we love to try and say, oh, reparations, this direction. Who owned what? Last I checked, I don't own anything. I'm just a man walking the face of this planet. Okay. I don't pretend that I own this land. Sure, I create the rules, and the only reasons why that works is because society says it works. That's it. But society might collapse tomorrow, and then I have to do what I need to do to protect the fruit trees, and I'll die there. Hence the name Valhalla, and we're going to end it here because I have to go. But
yeah,
the name Valhalla is off the Norse Viking kind of mentality, okay? It's the place where the Vikings that lived an honorable life, man or woman, would die, and if they lived an honorable life, meaning in accordance with their own values as well as the kind of collective values of the community or of the tribe that they're a part of, in this case the Vikings or the Norse, if they did, they went to the land of Asgard, and the land of Asgard was this great hall called Valhalla, where they would party, they would train for the battle of Armageddon, for the battle of good versus evil. I'm not here to tell you what good is. I'm also not here to tell you what evil is, but guess what? You have a version inside of you, the listener who's listening to this, of what good and evil is. Find the people who have the same common enemy as you, and therefore you'll find the people who are your same common friends in many scenarios. So some people think that common enemy is the government. Some people think it's social justice warriors. Some people think it's this, that, and thing, that thing. It's the Republicans, it's Democrats. I don't care what you think the common enemy is. I'm not here to tell you what it is. I'm just here to build my version of my community and what I'm looking to do with other people. Now, I've done that successfully. Successfully have community around me all the fucking time. And it's won and lost by the fact that the boat sinks or swims, and that's it. And guess what? The Vikings, when they went and found and pillaged new land, they had to get there together, because if the boat sunk, they all died. Whoever wanted to be king of the new land, that's another story. They'll fight for it later.
Worry about that later.
At the end of the day, the democracy of reality dictates all. And it's just as democratic as it gets. And your personal safety and your personal happiness is not the responsibility of other people, period. The more we try and make it the responsibility of other people, that's where we start to fudge the lines of freedom, okay? And that's what people are worried about. Oh, I have to call you by this pronoun or this thing, and then, oh, that hinders my freedom. I get it. I understand the arguments on both sides, okay? I understand the social justice warriors, and I also understand the freedom fighters. And to be honest, I'm none of the two. I'm one and the other. If you want me to call you they, them, fine, I'll call you they, them. But if you want me to do it to the point where I'm going to have legal repercussion, whether or not I do it or not, that's another story. Okay. Mm-hmm. So yes, there is a line in the sand for me. Okay. Socially, I fully respect it. I understand it. I get it. I understand that somebody doesn't identify this way or that way or the other thing. But guess what? What you identify as is not my responsibility. What's in your bank account is not my responsibility. Whether you sink or swim, whether you die from COVID or not, is not my responsibility. Whether you live or die is not my responsibility. But if I'm the one who made you die, then yes, it becomes my responsibility. If I'm infringing on your freedoms, it becomes my responsibility in some way, shape, or form. That's why we have the Charter of Human Rights. That's why we have the Declaration of Independence. That's why we have some of these things. So yes, I see an enormous amount of value in those structures, okay? And in those paradigms and the things that defend that. And guess what? I think we're doing a pretty decent job of defending it in many ways. We're losing the fight in certain cases. We've got a lot of problems, but I love what at the end of the day is we're all fucking pirates. We're all just inventing it. I'm inventing it as much as you are, period.
Mark Angelo Coppola.
Yeah, that's the name.
Coop Fermes Valhalla. Coopfermes Valhalla, Valhalla.
Yeah.
.com. You know, we're not done with this conversation. We'll pick it up in the future. It'll be more about you. Because I always, why are you this way? What happened? It was a coach, a teacher, something did something that, you know, we'll get to that another time.
Yeah.
But I tell you, you know, the fact that you've been successful, it's 9 years, the future's bright. You're good. You know, it's happening.
I feel great about my future. I'm
glad that you spent this extra time with us. We get to know it. And I kind of knew that we're going to be going down this way. And I'm just getting more and more confirmation bias, you know, of it's going to be individuals and entrepreneurs and private of this is it and who agrees. And
you can't expect the government to build it for you. They're not going to. Nobody's going to build it for you.
Thank you. Well, thanks for building. And as far as we are here, we're looking forward to keeping track of what you're doing. Is there another website or anything else you want to or contact?
Nah, ladies and gentlemen, you already know where the links are. Hit subscribe, hit that like button, leave a comment. Those are all helpful for the algorithm and for the show. And we'll see you in the next episode.
Peace.